For a voice of crying is heard out of Zion, for we are greatly confused. But death has come into our ghettos to cut off the young men and women from the streets of Philadelphia, New York, L.A., Georgia, Ohio, Florida, Mississippi, and throughout America, South America, the Caribbean islands, Africa, Asia, and all over the world. So return unto me, thus saith Yah, and I will return unto you, O my people.
Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all that getting, get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforawakening.com. That's timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and listen to the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and listen to the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. That's in the black belt. That's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and the live stream is playing at that location also. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for Awakening. You'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the auxiliary connection. That, again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media, the homepage, is there. And 99% of the changes are completed with the addition of some of the new programs. The icons for their home pages and their podcasts. Everything is just about in order. And also you can listen to other podcasts and other information that's on the site. So make that one of your favorites. If it's not, put that in the address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us. Organizer and CEO of the Indica Group, Brother Diallo Sumbri, will be with us this evening in conversation. We'll be talking about the deal that the Indica Group has signed with the Ghana Tourism Authority to promote tours and investment in Africa for Black Americans and other related topics dealing with that. And then afterwards, because I know that our guest is scheduled to leave on a flight around 10:30, so hopefully he can stay with us the whole time. If not, we'll transition into open forum where we can have conversation with our listeners. But we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072, spelled new as in numerous, on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Ellis.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I've got a little, with this cold, I've got a little nasal thing. I hope the listening audience, I want to apologize to them in advance. But other than that, everything looks good. It's cold outside, and therefore I'm inside.
Yeah, well, you get over that cold. I guess tomorrow you'll put on your four pair of long johns, and then you're going out there. Oh, boy. You know, Richard, yeah. I'm glad to have our guest. You know, we had him scheduled the other week, and just a little scheduling snafus happened, and he came on during the time, I think, when we had Cynthia McKinney, or it might have been a week before.
Yeah.
And I promised to get him back on because I wanted him to talk about what the Indigo group is doing down there in College Park, Maryland. You know, it's just a long list of things that our people, because a lot of our people that don't have the information and they rely on the television and fake news, so to speak, talking about, you know, our people are not doing anything. It's a lot of our people out here in these cities and in these small towns that are doing things that our people need to know about and join in and help and be a part of. And what Brother Diallo is doing down in College Park is necessary for our people to know. And I'm glad he's with us this evening to share the information about the Indigo group and the memorandum of understanding that they have signed with the Ghana Tourism Authority. I want to welcome in Brother Diallo. Brother Summary, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Loud and clear.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you for having me on. I apologize for the last time again as well.
Oh, it's, that's
it's no, good to be here.
That's no
good
problem. That's no problem. Listen, we're glad to have you here. You know, before we get into, because, you know, when I ran across the information, you know, it really kind of excited me because on the program a couple of years ago, we had a brother by the name of Halevi. His last name was Halevi. He was a part of the PANAFEST celebration that they had in Ghana, and he was talking about things that they had planned to move and do in a 5-year window, and we hadn't had him back on. In fact, I had difficulty trying to reach him. I think his number might have changed because he had repatriated to Ghana, to Africa. I know he was living in Ghana, but you know, when I ran across your information, I knew that this is something that our listening audience needs to know about, and I wanted you to share it with us. But before we talk about some of the things that you're doing moving into 2018, talk about the Indinka group down there in College Park. Is that right outside of Washington?
Yeah, well, so the Adinkra Group as a company is based in D.C., actually.
Okay.
But our studios, we have a few studios that are based in Mount Rainier, Maryland.
Okay.
Which is between D.C. and College Park.
So, okay.
You know, it's one of those situations where you cross the street and you're in Maryland, you go back and you're in D.C.
Okay, all right. But tell us a little bit about the group.
Situations.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the group.
So the Adinkra Group is an African cultural resource company. So what that basically, and we do several things. So we own and operate the Adinkra Cultural Arts Studios. We don't own the buildings yet, but as you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint, so we're getting there. But we have four studios in Mount Rainier, Maryland, where we teach and promote traditional West African culture through drum, dance, and lectures, right, and other special events. So we host introductory djembe classes, dance for young women and men, for children and adults, youth ages 2 or 3, you know, walking potty trained as long as they'll participate in class through adult. We also have Asa African Dance Fitness, which is a program developed by actually my cousin, Akosua, and that is an African dance fitness program. We have a studio art gallery, which serves as a community space for folks who, you know, want to host different events for their families or even other events such as poetry readings, art shows, and things like that. And then we have the Ashley Pure Boutique, which is run by another sister in the community named Thea, and that's where they have homemade soaps, shea butter, oils, incense. You can buy some nice African wear there, as well as accessories. So one of the things we do is we manage and run the Adinkra Cultural Arts Studio. The other thing that we do is we manage Fatafina Khan, the Sound of Africa, which is our performing ensemble. And that ensemble, again, is from ages 3 through adult, where we teach African culture and African cultural science through the drumming and dancing and the arts. Our other focus is something that we call Birthright Journeys. So Birthright Journeys is where we organize trips to the continent. And we like to try to take people who've never been to the continent and give them an introduction. And over the course of that process, it's a cultural immersion trip. So, you know, we deal with the different sides of the countries we go to. So far right now, we're only doing Ghana, but I know that we'll expand to Senegal, South Africa, and Kenya, you know, in the coming years. So that's what Birthright Journeys are. One of the things that make our Birthright Journey special is that one of our partners, AfricanAncestry.com, we allow people to take their African ancestry test, and then we will reveal their ancestry while we're visiting the continent, which is something that's special.
Okay.
And the other part of our Birthright Journeys is special events, which is our Back to Africa event that we're doing in February. So that's basically what the Adinkra Group is, right? Now, what we wind up doing is helping people understand African culture, because we do performances in schools and, you know, people call and say, hey, I want some African drummers to come beat out a rhythm and dance for me for my wedding or for this. So we help people understand that Africa is a continent, that there are 54 countries, that there's a lot of cultures, you know, so we're really teaching about African culture through the arts and education.
Brother Summer, before we, because I think going down the path of the birthright journeys, that'll kind of lead us into the other part of the conversation. But let me go back.
Okay.
Now, are you a musician yourself?
I am a musician. I started drumming. First of all, I was born and raised in Trenton, New Jersey, so shouts out to all my Trentonians listening. I'm a product of African-centered schools.
Okay.
Beginning with APAS, African People's Action School. My mother, Mama Makini Niliwambiani, is one of the founders, along with Baba Imwalimu Shuja, who I'm sure you know as an author and historian, Baba Amin, and a couple of other mamas and babas, Mama Quelly in Trenton, New Jersey. And then when I moved to D.C. in 89, I'm a product of Nation House Positive Action Center, or Watoto Shule, all our CB schools, Council of Independent Black Institution Schools. So, you know, so this is not being involved in a culture and what some of my friends we laugh about that we now call professional blackness is not new to me. You know what I mean?
Okay.
It's something that I grew up doing. under a lot of historians and teachers. So for me, it's really a continuation. You know what I mean? It's a continuation of what my parents did. It's a continuation of what my teachers did.
Well, you know, that's part of my question, because I wanted your perspective on this, because, listen, we see a lot of things going on in some of our communities and a lot of foolishness, or some foolishness happening by adults and youth, because it's no direction. It's no barometer. It's no guidance. You are a living witness that can attest to it, but I want you to put on your other hat and look at some of the folks that have come through the cultural studios, your Ndinga cultural studios, and the young people, and looking at them as they're growing through their stages of life. And you might have a reflection on some young people that have, you know, grew into maybe young adulthood. How do you see that exposing them to the culture of our ancestors and their lifestyles, their principles, how do you see that that have transformed their life? Can you see a difference in how they behave or how they interact? Talk about that from your perspective.
Oh, most definitely. I always say that the reason why I never sold drugs is because I had to come home. You know, I had a community. So having to face a community when you know better made a big difference for me, right? Because even being raised the way I was raised, you know, like I was always clear when I was doing dumb stuff that, hey, I wasn't raised this way. So make sure if you catch me doing some dumb stuff when I was younger or out hanging or just, you know, being mischievous, this wasn't that I was raised. This is fully my choice. You know what I mean? Like, so I even went through my own phase of rebellion. You know what I mean? Being attracted by the streets or just, you know, doing the things that teenagers do.
Okay.
I went through that phase, and then I came to that crossroads the way that every other person, I believe, especially if you grow up in a community such as mine with a nationalist or Pan-African perspective, where you're going to come to a crossroads and you're going to decide whether or not you're going to live the way that you were raised and whether or not you're going to make that a part of your commitment at some level, or if you won't go the other way and just get a job. And I'm not, I don't mean to say just, but you know, you're going to get a job, raise a family, and go home and not necessarily do more than that with regards to community work and the culture and how you represent it. And, you know, when I came to that crossroads, I made a choice that this was my calling, that it was a part of what I was born to do, was to help to represent African culture and to help introduce people to culture. But as I see, like, my own son, who's a junior at the New School studying jazz percussion in New York, my nephews, my nieces, it makes a humongous difference, number one, because you grow up understanding that you are not just a descendant, not even just, but that you are not the descendant of a slave.
Okay.
Right? And that your life and your history didn't start in 1619 or whatever other year is chosen as a slave, and then we rose up. So, you know, now we're just trying not to be slaves anymore. That's one thing. The other thing is that the cultural programs that are put in place, the drumming, the dancing, even going through rites of passage, which is something that, I did, something that my son did, my daughter did. It's a structure. It gives you a framework. It gives you a paradigm to work through and live in. And everybody doesn't make it out of that because, you know, you have willpower, so you have choice. Some people choose other things, or outside influences are just too strong. You know what I mean? Too strong for you to resist You know, and you might abandon some of the ways that you were raised. You might abandon those principles of or you might abandon the Nguza Saba in your everyday life. You know what I mean? But it's like what we see in our community, and I can start with me, it saved my life, having this sense of culture. You know what I mean? Having this sense of foundation. I see what it did for my son. I see what it does for my nephews. You know what I mean? Because you can't be out there going totally crazy when you have this foundation and you have these systems of accountability and protocol that you have to follow. And I think a lot of times that's what's missing, accountability and protocol, because you're not set up in a community or a structure where you got to start off calling everybody mama and baba as a young person. So you give them adults who you may not even know the same respect you give your mother and your father. You know, some of those simple things right there, I think, help a lot in terms of African culture. Now, my personal perspective is it is the thing that will cure our people.
Okay.
Is being introduced to culture, right? Is being introduced to it at a young age, being introduced to the protocol behind it, being introduced to the responsibility, the accountability, and more than that, the magic of it, the richness of it, the authenticity of it, the originality of it, and the power in it. You know what I mean? Because I think otherwise, sometimes we just be lost. You know, we just kind of be lost as if, like, we trying to fit into something that we can't fit into. You know, if you're just trying to be the all-American guy, you're going to run into a situation that you don't fit into. You're going to run into a situation, I don't care how far you go, you see it with athletes, you can see it with what's happening with the NFL, whatever. You run into that situation where it's just like, okay, you know, you get your nigga wake-up call, and now you got to figure out how to be black because what you thought was cool is not. And you reminded that you black, so you less than. You know what I mean? So it's my thing that when you have that cultural foundation, when you have that understanding, you know that you're not really trying to fit into the system. You're just adapting yourself to move through it and use it as you need to so that you can accomplish your mission before you get up out of here. That's the way I look at it.
You know, before I transition, and I'm getting ready to start talking about the Birthright movement and the Back to Africa tours the agreement that you signed with the Ghana Tourism Authority. Before I do that, Richard, did you want to mention some things before we start talking about some of the other?
If I can, Brother mm-hmm. Sumbri, I wanted to really kind of continue to build on and have you assist in showing the listening audience this here intergenerational transference of institutional building. I'm intrigued to hear, you know, you're saying your family, this structure that you grew up in, now you're duplicating and your children are also, and your nephews are also a part of that. The reason why I want you to kind of elaborate on your journey in that institutional building, because a lot of us think that this is something that is just going to happen compared to is a continuation of going on. That is the cultural institutional development. How do you see that?
Well, I don't think anything just happened. So, you know, I always feel like I'm in debt to my mom and my community of elders for staying strong. You know, my mom was the first to introduce African culture to my family. My family is a heavily African-American Methodist Episcopal family. Been going to church since the 1800s. And we have a joke in our family because my grandmother traced our history back and found out that we were kind of emancipated some years, you know, before normal or before, you know, whenever the U.S. emancipated enslaved Africans. So my family, like, that's why we talk so much and think we know so much, because we got free early. Right? It's a little joke in my family, but my mom introduced that to my family, and she had to be strong. She had to say, no, my children are not going to eat pork. No, they're not going to church. And it took my family years to come around and accept that, right? I mean, even though they always accepted it, but it took them years to say, okay, so this is something that's real. It's not just a fad that you're going through. You know what I mean? You're not just not straightening your hair and wearing the afro and going to these meetings and things like that because, you know, because it's just something you're mad about. This is something that's real. You didn't give all your children African names at birth. Because, you know, no. So she had to be the one to stay in there, to stay strong, and to just be like, whatever, my family, my grandmother, great aunts, and all of that. And then she had to be the one, she had to be the one to introduce the Sunday dinner and look at my family history to see that how everybody was preachers and teachers. And she just had to stay strong. And then as my family saw us grow up, you know what I mean? And just like, oh, okay. So now at every family event, there's a libation and a prayer, right? There is somebody doing a drum call. We're dancing. You know, my grandmother just took her first trip to the continent of Africa not too long ago. So it's like now is fully accepted who we are. We're embraced, and it's, you know, and this is just like, okay, this is a powerful thing. So it's no longer, that's, you know, my Kenya and her kids doing the African thing, but my whole family's okay, we African. Like, now everybody can see that it's okay to be African. It's okay to say that you're African, but it took that time. So now that people see us in our generation, you know, we have the studios and the locations, and we actually have the space where we can be unapologetically who we are. You know what I mean? Where we can have our combs, our bembes, where we can have our events, where we can be unapologetically Black without having to, you know, dilute it in any way because the owner of a place doesn't want that type of thing in there or whatever things that people have to deal with when they don't have their own space. So, you know, so for, so it, it doesn't just happen. Like, I just tell my son, I will remove my foot off the back of your neck after you graduate high school. And even then, it ain't too far away, right? Mm-hmm. But I had to do that. I knew that I had to keep my foot right there. And then when he got a full scholarship to the new school, and it's like, dude, you're getting $65,000 a year tuition free. That didn't just happen. That happened because we made sure you drummed. We made sure that instead of just playing the, not, I don't want to say just playing the sport, but instead of doing what everybody else did, you stayed with drumming. You stayed focused with this. I didn't let you do all of the things that your other friends did, that you had to come to our homes. You had to come to these cultural programs. Like, it's work. It's not something that just happens, that, no, you're going to go to an independent African-centered school. And then when I took, when we took them out of an independent African-centered school, you still had that base of education, you know what I mean, from your community that was instilled in you. So you know, it's not something that just happens. It's something that requires work, and people have to stay strong because with the internet and social media nowadays, it's so easy for children to justify to their parents that it's a new generation and a new time, and we don't do that stuff that y'all did. But what you see happening right now is everybody is now clenching and holding on to the heaviest and the strongest part of their Blackness, because you got a fool in the White House who is just blatantly telling you what the other what the other people did. The other people was a little bit smoother, calmer, better words, and they just didn't flat out say, I hate you. But now that you got somebody in your face spitting on you, now it's just like, oh, damn, well, I don't have nothing to hold on to. Well, let me find out who I am. Let me hold on to my culture because it's being attacked. So let me learn it, attach it to myself, and hold on to it because that's the only thing that I got to hold on to. So, you know what I mean? It's like, it's we got to, it ain't easy, right? It's not easy. I know my mom didn't give up on me, you know, so she kept on me as long as she could. And the same with our children. And I already know that my children, my son and my daughter, my son just had a son, he's going to do the same thing with his daughter, right? And I'm around for my granddaughter. And my daughter, when she has a family, they're going to grow up and do the same thing. Everybody going to dance. Everybody going to drum. Everybody going to be in the culture. This is who we are. Everybody going to travel back and forth to Africa. Everybody going to eat fufu with their hands. You know what I mean? Like, so I hope I answered the question, but it's one of those things that it ain't easy, and it's work.
And what's important, or, you know, what I wanted to, and you did answer the question, and what's important that you're emphasizing, one, again, reiterating what you said, that it isn't easy to maintain an African culture in a hostile environment, whether it's personal or by the social environment we're in. But two, that the consistency and what I see that you're able to do, and what your, you know, what your mother and what your parents and your extended community did, the institution of that independent school, now you're through the Adinkra group is running another independent school through that, and now linking that up, which has always been our, and I just want to reemphasize that trajectory that of going back to Africa in relationship to having that agreement. That's an institutional, economic, social, cultural, intergenerational project.
Exactly.
That is going on. And it's important for us to see that it didn't just happen with you. Right?
Not at all.
You know, and it just even didn't just happen because your mother was introduced by somebody introducing. So
yep.
We, you know, I just want the listening audience, because a lot of times we talk like this is not going on, and people like yourself who are making these linkages are not, we're waiting for them to happen. compared to they're there and they're asking for our support, mm-hmm. which will lead me to my next question about, I understand that you are having a GoFundMe for the cultural dancer.
Yeah, so that one, actually, I actually need to close it. We were doing some updates and remodeling to the studio, which we had completed that first phase of it. And those donations were a big help to do that. I guess I should also state that we're 100% independent. You know, I'm still one of the people who are going back and forth with that, you know, with grants, with government funding, and with funds from other people, always comes some level of instruction, always come, you know, some level of parameters, because if you're cashing, if you're using somebody else's money, you know, you got to decide if you want to take that check, if they're asking you to do something that is a direct affront to what you believe in, right? So you got to decide, well, do I just work two jobs to make this happen so that I can stay independent and I can stay, you know, unapologetically who I am? Or do I just say, well, I'm going to be quiet about this, but be loud about what's acceptable? And it's just a choice that all of us have to make when we get into this. And, you know, and then it forces us to be enterprising. It forces us to be entrepreneurs. And it forces us to rely on our community and to figure out ways to make it work, because the reality is that it does take money. You know, it does take money or resources somehow in order for us to continue to do this. And that's what, you know, that's something that we've been blessed to be able to continue to do as a family so far. It's not easy by far. But, you know, it's something that I've been saying, I guess, recently, it's part of the process, you know, so it's not a burden as much as it is a part of the process, because eventually you get to that point where, you know, economically you can function in a way based on the things that you set up and the relationships that you've built, where, you know, you don't have to work, where you can speak truth to power without worrying about being defunded. You know what I mean?
Hey, Brother Summer, yeah. You told Richard that you're ready to close it out, or you're closing it out. So that means you reach your goal.
Yeah, we reached our goal with that. We're closing that one out.
Well, that's great.
We have some other projects. Yeah, we have some other projects that we're actually about to launch some community support for. You know, and I think what it speaks to is the families that we have that come to us for the drumming and dancing or for whatever. Number one, they see our entire family involved. So if they don't see me and my brother and my sister, they see my mom, they see our children, and they see our children as products, right? So it's just like, well, hey, this worked with your kids, you know what I mean? So we get families who are not as deep into the things that we are in, but some of the common threads and the common characteristics that keep us working and that keep families coming to us is they see we operate with the protocol, with the level of accountability. And we're not necessarily, and we're not judgmental in that, well, if you don't have this dashiki, then this mean that you're not this, or if you don't do this, then no, we don't really deal like that. We create a space for people to come in to be free and to get what we have to offer. You know what I mean? And then those people who come in, they see it, they love it, their children love it, you know, and they bring their aunts, cousins, and nephews. They come to our concerts and they just like, yo, what you guys are doing are powerful. You know what I mean? What you all are doing is a powerful thing. We want to be involved and we appreciate what it does for our family. So,
you know, and I just want to close with in my question, Elliot, and to you, brother from Sunbury, is that for the listening audience, because again and again we hear these institutional developments, and it requires us from wherever we are, once we hear that these institutions are being developed, and as you say, the difficulty that it takes, how we can, even with our penny, be supportive, or with our time, can be supportive. And I think that is a lesson that we must learn from history, because we had independent, a lot of African-centered cultural institutions, say, in the 60s or 50s. But they needed a larger community support, and they focused on the families that were around, but they need all of us to make those institutions work, to make those institutions thrive and survive through this hostile environment. So it's important for us and the listening audience, when we hear people like yourselves, your family like yourself, an institutional building like yourself, to recognize, to ask ourselves the question, how can I be supportive in whatever way from where I am to make this institutional process continue to another generation? That's the reason why I wanted to want you to continue to bring out the point of the that what you're doing.
I appreciate that.
Brother Summer, the Birthright tours, or the Back to Africa tours, Heritage tours. I want to touch on the three things. I want to touch on the opportunity for investment to develop and make, maybe create businesses for our people. Mm-hmm. But it all starts with the tours, the mm-hmm. people going there. Talk about the relationship that you have with the Ghana Tourism Authority and the development of the tours. Talk about it.
So I was fortunate enough to travel to the continent of Africa my first time. I think I was 10, 11, 12. We went with, my mother was able to figure out a way to take all of her children with Mainwunda Kiyete School of West African Dance and Drum in New York.
Okay.
Because living in Trenton, New Jersey, you know, my mom made the sacrifice where every Sunday we drove up to New York for classes. That's how we started. Like, you know, naturally as kids, we didn't want to do that. We wanted to stay home and watch Kung Fu Theater, you know what I mean? Or play kickball. But it's like, no, you're going to go drum, you know? So it's just kind of, we always laugh about it now. And my brother do, just thinking about the times that we, you know, got in trouble, got whoopings, or just was mad because we had to go drum and dance. And now it's part of the ways that we support ourselves. So I was able to go then. And then I think I went another time when I was 14. So being young and just having traveled to the continent of Africa, it's just, I fell in love early. You know what I mean? I fell in love early. I fell in love with Africa with this, you know, I was a young man, but it was, I went with Baba Jimo Kayate in Memory of African Culture. And we went to a restaurant once. I remember this story exactly because this one, I was just like, I love Africa. But this was the thing that led me to be like, I got to come back. I was eating some fish and it just had a lot of bones in it. And I was just having a hard time. And some beautiful African sister came out the back, took my plate from me, brought it back, and it had not nan bone in it. And I was like, I am in love with Africa, right? But I was 14, 15. So naturally, you know, when you're young, you're like, yeah. But as I got older and I started traveling, it was just like, for me, I always tell people that I am literally different there. I feel like I'm my true self or whatever that means. And I can literally feel the difference between my connection with the earth. Like when I get off the plane and I'm on a continent, it's just being there, regardless of what I'm doing. It's just being there where I feel different. I feel stronger. I feel better just about life. Some of that has to do with not having some of the same worries that you have as a black man here. And it just feels a lot more free to me. So that's like my thing about being on the continent as much as possible, the weather, the food, the people, the language, the colors, the music, the feeling, everything. Like I literally feel like there's a stronger connection from the core of the earth through my body to the sun. Like I literally feel like, you know what I mean? Like, hey, when I'm there, I'm, you know, it's just so different for me what I get when I'm there, what my body gets, the energy that I get from being on a continent. I decided to start doing tours because I was traveling and, you know, with Facebook and other stuff, you know, I would go live or, you know, and just talk to my friends and just be like, yo, we here, you know, we turning up, whether we had a party or whatever. And so a lot of people was just like, yo, man, I'm trying to go to Africa with you because you make it seem so fun. And it's not, you know, I've seen different parts. Like you're in the country. You ain't just, you know what I mean, at the resort. You like in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, yeah, yeah. So at first I was like, I ain't really trying to bring people because I'm still learning so much, right, about Ghana or any other country, Senegal. And I want to learn and I want to be able to move in a way. Well, I don't have a group of people with me who wonder why we got to eat with our hands or, you know what I mean, who just, I'm okay without all of America's creature comforts sometimes, even though you can go to a lot of parts of Africa and never have to experience anything that you might deem to be inconvenient or less than American creature comforts if you wanted to and still be on the continent.
Okay.
So I started to do the tours, really from that, from people asking. We had developed our group 4 years ago. We created Birthright, which is our annual concert. And Birthright, I heard Birthright in a conversation or something. I can't remember where I heard it. And I was like, Birthright. I was like, what is my birthright? So when I started doing research in Birthright, all I found was information about Jewish people. And I started to think, man, if anybody should be talking about their birthright, and if anybody should be, you know, being proud of their birthright, it's African people. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we called our concert Birthright. And Birthright is about, you know, sharing the joy, the magic of West African drum and dance on stage with other forms of art. But it pushes the idea of what is your birthright, right? So we say that all that Africa is and all that Africa has to offer belongs to us for the simple fact that we were born, African children, and it's our birthright to access and to have all that Africa has to offer. That transition to the Birthright Journeys, where we take people there, and it's really an introduction. You know, we believe that all we have to do is introduce you, and that from that introduction, you're going to find your own magic. There are going to be people who decide, I don't ever want to come back. There are people who are going to decide, I'm coming back as soon as I can. And there are people who at least are going to come back and tell somebody else and just say, yo, like, Africa is such a beautiful place. And for us, we got to start there, right? Before we can get too deep with different people, we just got to start with, just come to the continent and see for yourself. Meet the people, you know what I mean? Eat the food. Attend a ritual or ceremony, learn about the history, about the culture, go out to a club, go out to a party, just be there and enjoy, right? So that's what we do with our Birthright Journeys, specifically. That led to the project Back to Africa, which really was about, so I'm in D.C. Are you all familiar with go-go music?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm a big go-go music fan and advocate. And the Backyard Band happens to be my favorite band. I've been going to see Backyard for 20 years. And for years, you know, I would tell the leader of the band, look, man, I'm going to take y'all to Africa one year. I'm going to take y'all to Africa. Just because I kind of felt like, man, this is so African. Go-go itself is so African. Everything about it is African. And I just, you know, in my mind, the way I am, I'm one of those enterprising guys. I see something, I hear something. I want to put it on stage. I want to create something about it. I move on it. So a couple of years ago, I started talking to the band about it. We put it together. And then I was, okay, we're going to take the Backyard Band to Africa. It's going to be called Back to Africa. We're going to film this documentary about go-go music, finding its African roots. And that had a lot to do with what I believe it can do for the culture here in D.C. and go-go music and just, you know, it will open up for people here in D.C. and go-go music bands and other people to be like, yo, Africa, right? But the other thing is that I want people to know that in parts of Africa, Ghana, other countries, that you have options. Like, there are markets, there are thriving markets where you could find some success in as a music artist, as a hair braider, as an entrepreneur, as an engineer, whatever. So I want to introduce people to Africa and have them start asking more questions, right? Have them deciding to visit more or take a private trip with them and their friends. And just, I want to see more of us on the continent because everybody else is there in droves, right?
Okay.
So I was introduced to the CEO of Ghana Tourism Authority. He was in Washington, D.C. at a meeting, a good friend of mine, Dr. Gina Page, co-founder of AfricanAncestry.com. Was like, hey, the CEO of Ghana Tourism Authority is in town, and if you're taking this band to Africa, you should definitely talk to the Tourism Authority. So, you know, I somebody introduced me to him. I could set up a meeting. Would you like to meet him? I said, definitely. Went to the meeting. I explained to him what Birthright is. I explained to him what this project is, and he immediately said, we need to partner. You know, we need to partner. We should definitely partner. We want to be a part of this. Because one of their goals happened to be increasing the tourism of African Americans to Ghana. And I think with this new administration, what they see is a lot of people coming to Ghana, but we aren't coming as much as we used to. Because there was a time, like you talked about PANIFEST, when PANIFEST was in its prime, and other times where droves of African Americans were going to Ghana to visit Ghana. And I believe those numbers have dropped. So that being something that this administration is focused on is increasing the amount of African diaspora and travelers to Ghana. And I guess me meeting him and just seeing me as a, you know, a single individual, a small company relatively, well, it's no small, and just what our passion was in driving to it. And I was like, hey, I'll be in Ghana with a group of kids, you know, a group of middle school kids, and I'd come by and meet. So we meet, we talk. And once we talked, then he kind of heard what my vision was for Birthright Journeys, our connection with AfricanAncestry.com, and the work that we were already doing, right? Nobody's paying us to do this work. The work that we were already doing, it just made sense for us to create a partnership, that helps to promote African-Americans, diaspora, and Africans traveling to Ghana. Ghana has the right to abode. Ghana is considered the gateway to Africa. Ghana is English-speaking. And for me, as a, you know, if I looked at it as a tour operator, I felt like Ghana was also, quote unquote, a safe place to land for people who are visiting Africa for the first time, right? Because there are other, I mean, I could take you to parts of Mali. I could take you to parts of Guinea. I could take you to other parts of Senegal. I could take you to, you know, Ivory Coast. We could go to Nigeria. We can go to a lot of parts. But I want to make sure also that people's first time in Africa is a positive experience. And one of the things that helps is it's an English-speaking country. It also helps if it has a good level of tourism already. And it also helps that Ghana is the first independent sub-Saharan African nation. So there's a historical element to Ghana and the fact that it has some standing slave castles or dungeons, however you want to relate to it there, so that people can have that experience there. You know what I mean? So all of those things kind of added up to us having this MOU, which we are still developing. You know, we're still developing what that looks like, what it means, and how we'll work it. But our first project is this Back to Africa tour with the Backyard Band, where we're filming a documentary, and they'll perform three times. So it's introducing a unique form of African-American music to the people in Accra, in Cape Coast. And the band will also learn some of the traditional customs, culture, and music. And the Tourism Authority has asked us to make it an annual festival. So now we're working with them, you know, for next year, too, to say, okay, we're going to keep this coming every year during Black History Month, where we're bringing groups of people to Ghana specifically during that time, as well as helping with some of the other festivals. So we're developing.
So they're going to have a festival. They're going to have a festival at this particular time to link up with y'all doing, or there is already a festival going on?
We're basically creating it.
Okay.
Creating it. So we'll be there February 26th through March 6th. So it'll always go from the end of February through Ghanaian independence, which is March 6th. So we'll move from Black History Month into Ghanaian independence. You know what I mean? So... Mm. So it's becoming a festival, right? As opposed to it just being this one-off, hey, the Backyard Band is coming, they're going to perform and shoot the documentary. It's now becoming a festival every year where we're working together to attract more African-Americans to see the beauty and majesty of Ghana, see what it has to offer. And one of the ways you can get people to do that is to say, hey, you know, when you start looking at how our people are in the arts, so if your favorite singer or musician is going to be somewhere, you might want to follow them, you know? And if you can imagine what it would be like to see them in your hometown, a lot of people will want to be a part of seeing them perform on the continent, you know? So you're like, damn, Frankie Beverly and Maze going to be in Ghana? That's going to be amazing, right? Just because they're in Ghana. It's like, yo, I would want to see that. And sometimes that's what it takes to get people to say, I'm going to go to Africa. I'm going to make that commitment and go.
We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, Brother Summery, I want to transition into some of the conversations centered around investments and business opportunities for some of our people that go on the trip. But we'll do that when we come back. You can join the conversation also by dialing 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. It's people out here that's not only walking the walk or talking the talk, but walking the walk, creating opportunities. Some of our people is talking about it's time to be out of here. Here's opportunities. Here's the doors is being open for our people. These are the things that we talk about here, and we bring people on that's doing the work. Get involved in the conversation. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kamban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. We're in conversation tonight with a Negro Group CEO. Brother Diallo Zumbri is with us this evening to talk about the Ghana tourism and... hold on 1 second. Sundays, 7 p.m. Fridays at 8 p.m. To talk about the Memorandum of Understanding signed with the Indica Group with the Ghana Tourism Authority to promote tours and investment on the continent. And we're talking about that with our guest this evening. Brother Diallo.
Yes, sir.
Talk about, because you mentioned about the African heritage DNA that would be revealed to some of the folks that's on, to the folks that go on the tour while they're there on the continent. But talk about some of the business investments and the business opportunities that could be available for some of the folks that are interested in repatriating or even just becoming a citizen, leaving the states altogether.
Okay, so first I'll say that I think the last time I was supposed to be on, I was listening, and you had Brother Cambone on, who's a professor at the University of Ghana. Mm-hmm. So he's somebody who's been doing this work for a lot longer than I have, you know what I mean? And I look up to him in a lot of ways and what he's been able to do with his family there and his, you know, his foresight and his resolve to say, I'm out of here. There's another option, and I'd rather be with my people. So that's somebody who's also doing the work in there. A lot of people doing the work specifically in Ghana. A lot of diaspora and Africans and African-Americans who decided that they're going to move. You know, some come back and forth and some just say, I ain't never coming back.
Okay.
So there are a lot of us in Ghana specifically who are making a way and figuring this out. What I'll say with regard to investments, I don't have anything specific that I can say to people now that, hey, if you contact me, I can introduce you to XYZ. One of the things that I think is really important for us to do, for those of us who are looking to make investments, it honestly starts with a visit, right?
Okay.
You know, the way the entrepreneur's mind works is somebody else may see nothing and you may see opportunity. So depending upon what field or industry you're in, I could say that there's a lot of opportunity because the nation is still developing, right? So you would, number one, have to make a commitment to know that you want to do business in Africa. And sometimes that commitment could just come from whatever your industry is or whatever your business is, and sitting down and running the numbers. And you say, oh, wow, I can make this, I can make good money there, right? So it's not that I got to go there and struggle, but I can make good money, right? One of the things that we are doing and working on with the Tourism Authority is expanding our tours and working with them to folks that are in business, diasporan Africans, as well as continental Africans who run businesses and banking. It's about how do we introduce that to people here. So one of the things that we'll be releasing this summer is a tour specifically for that.
Okay.
So for people who are in business and who are interested in doing business specifically in Ghana, what we want to be able to do is to take the time, get the right people to the table, and do a tour specifically for people who are interested in being in business. So some of that is some research that we're doing with regard to the various markets. So whether it's hospitality and tourism, whether it's engineering, whether it's construction and building, whether it's technology, whether it's infrastructure, or whether it's retail, we are doing some research, organizing what those industries are, where the business opportunities lie in Ghana, and then we want to be able to advertise to people who are interested in going to Ghana so that we can match them up with the industries that they're looking for in Ghana and have a series of meetings to begin to discuss what it would look like to do business there, right? Mining as well. So one of the things that I'm really big on is taking the time to do the research and make sure that you have the receipt. So I want to be able to tell somebody, if you're going to Ghana with me, if I'm taking you there, I've been there, I've talked to the people that I'm introducing you to, I've vetted it, and then you're good to go. You know what I mean? So that people know, well, you know, when we go here, we know that we're good. But there's a lot of opportunity there. And what you'll find is, even if it's just opening up a store, you know, whether you're teaching yoga, the person, the first thing you have to do, honestly, to commit to whether you're going to Costa Rica, whether you're looking at operating from another base outside of the United States, is you have to almost divorce yourself from America in what you feel like, in the feeling that America is the only place that could offer you wealth, comfort, and anything else that you might be in love with here, right? So for all the reasons that people say, I ain't going to Africa or I ain't leaving, you have to come to grips with that and decide, you know, if you really want to do something somewhere else, right? And once you make that decision, now you start to travel and do research. There's an investment that you have to make in yourself. Right. Because okay. You just can't show up and be like, oh, I'm going to open a business. You got to learn the culture. You got to learn the protocol. You got to build good relationships. And then you have to start. So for me, this is me starting. Me making a way for other people, me sharing all that I'm learning, and me making sure that my children and my grandchildren know that I'm creating a place for you on the continent of Africa.
You know, you expressed in the beginning the relationship that you had with the African ancestry DNA group, and they introduced you to the tourism ministers in Ghana. A lot of these things start politically, and politically conscious individuals. I think that the thing that we're lacking in the diaspora here in the United States is politically conscious individuals that want to help our people. You see a lot of that happening on the continent. Myself and Brother Richard played a clip of the Ghanaian president a couple of weeks ago talking about that he wanted our people to start investing in themselves and keeping the young people, keeping that labor force, that mentality, that valuable resource among Africans. You see a lot of that happening on the continent. Unfortunately, a lot of those things don't reach the news where a lot of our people hear it in these cities and towns. You know, myself, Brother Richard, and other people hear these things. So,
right. You
know, what I'm saying is that I think it's necessary that if we don't have that political mindset here among some of the individuals that represent black folks here in the United States, it needs to be developed, because that's where a lot of these things start. It starts with political relationships. And when I use that term political, I'm not talking about this Democratic Republican foolishness that we know about here.
Yeah, I'm clear.
Yeah. So,
well, you know, it's, like I said, I believe that it's a commitment. I always feel like it's really necessary for me to underscore a couple of things, because the relationship with the Ghana Tourism Authority for me is fairly new, and we are entering into doing this work. But I always feel like it's necessary for me to say that I don't feel like I'm an expert. I feel like I'm doing my part.
Okay.
There are people who came before me who made the sacrifices so that I could come into the consciousness that I have, so that when the time arrived and it was my turn to take the baton and do my job, that I was prepared to do that. And I feel like that's what I'm doing, right? I feel like that's what I'm stepping into. So, you know, I wanted just to make that clear again. And there are people who've been doing it longer and different than I have, but this is me answering the call of my ancestors, tapping into what I believe my personal life mission to be, and then acting on that. And what I do is introduce people to it, you know? So it's like, so I feel like, well, if I'm able to take this relationship with the Ghana Tourism Authority and expand it in a way where there are other tour operators around the country or other people who may want to go, especially inside the school system, because when you look at the fact that there are now public and charter schools all over and people are putting a lot of money into it. And when they put a lot of money into it, these students take international learning experiences. But if you just do a little bit of research and look at some of the top companies that people are using to offer, you know, a lot of times our children, as well as other children, international learning experiences, they rarely go to the continent of Africa. They rarely go to the continent of Africa. You know, as far as most people are concerned, Africa's just full of diseases. So for me, in working with AfricanAncestry.com as opposed to any of the other competitors, is important. It's an all-black company. Not just the fact that it's an all-black company, but it's the only DNA company that can tell you where you're from. You know what I mean? The other places you go, you know, you might pay a little less, and they're going to say, hey, you're 65% African. As far as I'm concerned, that information is useless. Okay, I'm 65% African. Well, I knew that I was majority African. I could look at pictures in a book
okay. And
know that I'm African. But where am I from, right? Where are my ancestors from? And so the more that I started to learn and discover about AfricanAncestry.com, I knew that it was important for me to have a partnership with a company like this to, number one, help more people see that, hey, we have a company that's been around for 15, 14 years that is solely invested in helping black people recover from the identity theft that happened with the enslavement period.
Okay.
So you can find out that you are from, such as I did on my maternal line, that my DNA traces to the Fulani people of present-day Nigeria, or that my paternal ancestry traces to the Teke people of Gabon. Now, that gives me a sense of something more than I'm 60%. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
But then again, you can tell the difference, right, between what a black and an African-American and African company who cares about black people are promoting and doing versus another company that's really haven't really done that much or any research into Africa. Just to give you an example, and I do consider myself a promoter of AfricanAncestry.com because I fully believe in what they stand for and what they do.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens with this DNA tracing, and I'm not an expert, is your DNA is being compared to a database of samples that these companies have, right? And the database of samples that these companies have is how they determine what part of Africa you come from based on how your DNA aligns with the samples that they have in their database. AfricanAncestry.com has 33,000 samples, if I'm correct. The competitor with the next maybe has 500 samples or 700 samples. So when they're telling you that you're X percent Africa and from these areas or regions, it's based off an inadequate sampling. They don't really care. They don't really care if you find out what part that you're from. And it doesn't do you any good to know that you're X percent. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
So it's important for us to make alliances with other companies that care about black people. And for us to support each other,
yes.
You know, and for us to promote each other, and for us to figure out ways to work together to get the message out that we need to rely more on each other.
Okay.
And that's where you are is like really so important. What I like to continue to kind of emphasize, even with the Adinkra Group as a developing entrepreneurial what we call a cultural and commerce institution. In a developing stage, you know, enterprise, because as you get strong, which, as you say, your linkages with AfricanAncestry.com, they get strong, and then the relationship with the continent of the Ministry of Ghana, and they get strong. We all get strong in relationship to dealing with expanding our economic and social cultural space. So what I would like to come back to is, you know, yes, there's business opportunity in Ghana, but it seems that the question I have for you is, do you see business opportunity, investment opportunity in the Adinkra Group for those of us who wants to see homegrown intergenerational institution, economic institutions to continue to develop? do you see in the future or in that vision the possibility of that?
Definitely, very soon. So, like I always say, those people who, like a friend of mine taught me a valuable lesson last year about just shutting up, about not talking so much, but actually creating it, putting it in place, and then releasing it when it's time so that people can not just hear about your work, but as you say, talk about it, but walk the walk. So one of the things that I'm clear about is that people will make investments and people want to make investments. I'm also clear that the African continent is an excellent place for us to start. One of the ways that I'm clear about that is everybody else is there. And imperialists and colonizers and 100% pure capitalists, they don't go and invest in places where they can't make a profit. It's that simple, right? Mm-hmm. They don't do that. The other thing that's important is, you know, we're only one generation. Africa is only one generation into independence. So it's still early. It's still ground level, so to speak, right? Because with Ghana being gaining its independence from Great Britain in 1957, you are looking at a place that's coming into its own. It's beginning to come into its own, and the internet is helping. The fact that people are traveling back and forth is helping. So, like, retail in Ghana is only 10 years old. The first mall was built 10 years ago. So they're just beginning to understand retail, shopping, right? Even when you look at mobile technology, cell phones, even when you look at building, there are places in Ghana as well as other countries that are not yet developed yet. There is land that can be purchased, and you can begin to build and develop communities in spaces. So it's like you just really have to be committed to wanting to do that, right, and to wanting to see that that's possible. One of the things that we've decided to do, like I always tell people, I'm so close, my family and everybody knows, okay, you got one foot in and you got one foot out. I'm like, yes. Sometimes people say, why? And I say, go outside with no jacket on. That's one of the reasons why, because this ain't my weather at all.
Oh, you sound like Richard. You sound like Richard there, Brother Zumber.
This is not my weather at all. So one of the things that we're looking to do is establish ourselves as foot soldiers on the ground, right, that can develop projects, establish partnerships, okay, beginning in the country of Ghana with other individuals, and to be able to manage people's accounts and investments, right? A lot of times what we hear about countries in West Africa is that people steal, they're crooks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, people do that all over the world. West Africa is no exception, right? So you have to make good investments. You have to be smart. You have to be clear. You have to do your research. You have to have the receipts. You have to know that what you are doing is worth it. And I also know that a lot of us can't necessarily take the time off work, aren't willing necessarily to in their job or whatever to make that investment in Africa. However, and you're definitely not going to look at one of those emails that you get or go online and just send money to somebody to say, hey, here's, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 for an investment in whatever it is that you saw, and I'll look to get my quarterly report. But if you know that there's somebody who's been doing this work, who's from the States, who travels back and forth, and who's creating a program and creating a way for you to have investment, and somebody who's willing to say, hey, listen, I'm a manager accounts in Ghana for this thing that you want to invest in, whatever that may be. And we suggest that you show up once or twice a year to see how your money's working. You know what I mean? To be transparent about that. So one of the things that we are pushing to do with more research is to be able to be that person on the ground, to be that group of people on the ground, that committee of people on the ground who travel back and forth, that's able to help us find out where the best place to invest is, you know, how you can get a good ROI, and how you can do good with that, right? So I always say that people need to really make sure they have their why together. And I'm one of those people who's like, let's get money. Okay, let's get money, but why? I don't want to get money with you if you just, you know, if all you want to do is buy Gucci and party. That's not what I'm interested in getting money for. I'm interested in getting money so that we can invest it and build community. So okay. That the Adinkra Cultural Arts Studio that you see in Mount Rainier has a partner cultural center or studio in Ghana, West Africa, has a partner studio or center in Senegal or in Kenya or in Nigeria, where the youth that we are raising in our centers here, and as we're teaching them about African culture here, we can also say that, hey, once you get to this age or you get to this point, we have a program that allows you to go study in Ghana and begin to see and learn about the things that you've been, with your own eyes, that you've been learning about here. You can go over there and study culture. You can go over there and study protocol. You can learn about the traditional chieftaincy system in Ghana or the queen mothership and how that happens. You can learn how to be a chef. You can learn how to farm. You can learn how to build. You can do engineering. You can take your engineering that you've learned here and help to expand cell phone towers and technology in parts of Africa where it's not there. And that's a business that you can invest in and that you can make money with and help build and develop community, not just over there, but over here too. You know, so, and that for me takes some time. You know, it takes some research. I want to make sure that the partnerships that I have there are stable, the investments are stable, and that I can come back and say, hey, let me show you what I've been able to do with myself. And I'm going back and forth. And if you'd like to come over there with me to see this thing for yourself, I can show you. You know, I can show you better than I can tell you.
Let's go to BTR. BTR.
Hey, greetings, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm doing the best I can, taking in this very interesting broadcast tonight. What's your guest's name? I'm sorry, I didn't catch his name.
Brother Diallo Sumbri. He's the CEO of the Adinkra Group.
Siambri?
Sumbri.
Sumbri. Okay, greetings to you, Brother Sumbri.
Peace.
I have two questions. This is actually from something that we were discussing on a Black Business radio show that's on the Black Talk Radio Network from last Thursday. And one of the hosts played a clip. And we've all heard this clip about how many times the black dollar circulates in the black community, how many times the, you know, other people's dollars circulate in their own communities. Now, my question, though, is I felt like that clip that they played was they was leaving out a lot of variables. Like, for example, when we talk about, well, why do we have all these Koreans or all of these Chinese businesses in the black community? And then they were talking about, like, major companies like L'Oreal and how they contract with Asian companies and whatnot. And I feel like a lot of that isn't being explain on why they do that. And like, for example, China, places like China, Vietnam, even Indonesia, these are all Asian companies that are dominating the global market right now. And why are they dominating the global market? Well, if you take a country like China, it's a communist country. From people I know I've worked with that actually lived in China, they was like, yeah, the government take care of your basic health care needs and things of that nature. So they can pay those workers over there poverty wages. I even talked about stories about factories collapsing and hundreds of workers killed in Indonesia, where you got companies like Disney going into and, you know, contracting with those companies. And I actually worked with someone. I used to work in a textile company in the sourcing department. Well, what the sourcing department does is try to find companies abroad, not here in the United States, but abroad to produce their materials and whatnot at the cheapest rate possible. I used to work with a woman who used to work for Nike. And she said when she went to their factories, you know, some of the companies that was producing Nike goods in Vietnam, she was saying it was basically like the women were made to live in these buildings that were, you know, just inhumane conditions and whatnot. So I'm saying is, how do you compete with that without exploiting your own people? How do you compete with also the prison industrial complex, what we call slave labor, because slavery was never abolished? I was quite terrified to see that in a place like Uganda. I saw a video on YouTube because I follow a lot of African channels on YouTube. In Uganda, they're practicing prison slave labor. All right. They produce, they show, they did a story about prisoners producing a half a billion a year in cotton. Mm-hmm. And that just horrified me. And because of my work with the new abolitionist movement here in the United States, and we've been doing a broadcast pointing out that slavery was never abolished by the 13th Amendment. It just moved it from the plantation to the prison. Mm-hmm. We've even had people reach out to us from Ghana inviting us to come over there because they're seeing the same thing arise in Africa, especially with G4S, a British company, being the largest employer in Africa. So my question is, how do we compete with that, with those kind of global business practices? And then I have another question after you answer.
Let me start off by saying I'm no expert, and there's a lot that I'm learning and still learning. But the one thing that I do know that we also have to realize is that there are two sides to colonization. So there's one side that the Africans who were scattered all over the world are dealing with the effects of that and of the transatlantic slave trade and what that had done to us in the ways that we are trying to heal and recover. And sometimes I think what those of us who are descendants of the enslaved Africans who were scattered around the world have to also realize is that there is another side of colonization, and that is those Africans who are left on the continent and who are left there and are working their way through finding out how do they regain control over their businesses and their land and their industries on that side of colonization. Because, again, I mentioned earlier that the continent of Africa is literally one generation, only one generation out of being a dependent country or being ruled, you know, by one of these European nations. So, so for me, I would, number one, have us realize that it's still early in the game. It's still very early in the game, and it still has a lot. There still is a lot of work that has to be done in order for us to be able to compete with these global entities or these countries or these nations that are able to do some of the things that they are able to do. So there's an education that's required from us. And then we also have an obligation to educate our African brothers and sisters. But there are a lot of things that we're lacking, such as infrastructure, right? Outside of an African nation, African people all over the world are not considered a nation. You can't say that black people have a GDP of anything that they can import or export or a way to say. We could just say that black people are spending this amount of money. So it's one of those situations where, I mean, I don't have an answer, and I don't think anyone has an answer, at least not in this generation or the next, that will say this is the way that we solve that problem. But one of the ways that I believe that we can have an effect is to begin to travel there ourselves, see with our own eyes, and to begin to open businesses, educate our people over there, and to do things that can help change, even if it's a small microcosm or only a small part. But I feel like sometimes we don't necessarily see change or appreciate the change that is happening unless it's on a grand scale or is in a form of a constitutional amendment change or a big policy change, where sometimes I feel like it's really, really far off from where we are realistically, you know, in the world today. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's
because you answered it. I appreciate you being honest and saying you don't have an answer because you're still studying, you know,
exactly.
And this is a big problem. And my concern is black capitalism. emulating white capitalism to where we're exploiting our own people, you know, whether they're here on this continent, on North America, or whether they in Africa. That is my concern.
I made a Facebook post a little while ago, and I said, black people, when you travel to the continent, don't just take. Make sure you leave something there. I mean, a lot of that happens with education. You know what I mean? A lot of that happens with education. But you have to have a personal level of consciousness, because if you are in this, and I just mentioned this a little while ago, and I said, I'm about getting money too, but why? What is your why? So those of us who have the same why have to connect with others who have that why, right? So so you can open a business in Ghana and figure out a way to make, you know, maybe 5,000% profit like some of these companies are making. But now your personal consciousness has to say, if I know I can make this amount of money from whatever I'm doing here and distributing it through the world, whether it's a good or whether it's even a business that you're doing in Ghana, your personal consciousness is the thing that says, I don't need to make all of this money and keep it for myself, but I can begin to develop community and develop the people around me so that I can use this for good. You know what I'm saying? But it really takes, as far as I know and as far as I can see, we have to figure out a way how to do that, and we have to figure out a way to be able to go into a market, right, looking at it from a strictly business sense, see what the conditions of that market are, and figure out how to work within that market, right, and figure out how to move that market to a different space. And that may happen with, let's say, for example, you wanted to open up a bow tie company, and you decided to open up a bow tie company in Ghana, and you're employing 100 people who produce thousands of bow ties a day. Well, it's your company, and now you have the option to look at how much you can afford to pay those workers. So even if you feel like those workers or the average worker in Ghana is grossly underpaid, but you're able to take the profit from your company and then pay people more than other companies, even if it's still not maybe what we consider a living wage here, then you've done your part. You know what I'm saying? Or if you say, well, I want to offer free education or school to the children of the people who work in my factory, and I want to figure out how to help you either go to college, you know, somewhere else, or how can I benefit the universities here? And then you're preaching and you're teaching the people there that, hey, when you get your education and you get your degree, don't leave the continent and bring that over here. You know, you have a responsibility to develop your own community. So, you know, a lot of that is just each individual's personal consciousness and being able to link up with people who have that same why that you do. And again, it's the commitment. It's the commitment to, number one, make a trip. It's to make a trip and explore, you know. And I always say that young white hippies, they have the benefit of being able to do this because their parents got money or whatever, but they just sell everything they own and decide they're going to travel the world and see something. And most of us can't do that just because of our daily survival. But it's a commitment that we make. And I think that your question and your point is a good, that, you know, it is what is capitalism? So it doesn't really matter if you're black, if you're doing the same thing that others are doing. What is your why? Are you building community? Are you developing community? And then it's also not seeing anything wrong with making money, because sometimes I feel like we feel like if somebody's making money, there's something wrong with that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but it's, you know, it's building and developing that level of consciousness where you know that you're able to support yourself and you're able to earn enough money to sustain your business through impending tough times that we know is always around the corner, and that you're able to give back to your community.
Thank you for your calls.
I agree.
Thank you.
I have one more question.
Go ahead.
I have one more question. Now, I do believe in pan-Africanism, and what my definition of pan-Africanism is: African-descendant people, no matter where they are in the world, working with each other to better our global condition, no matter where we are. So I do believe in pan-Africanism, but at the same time, I live in this country. I was born in the United States, and when the United Nations comes here and conduct some do some research that we already knew, we didn't need the United Nations to come and tell us that black people in this country is living in extreme poverty. And I'm just wondering, you know, if we're looking to Africa and neglecting our own people right here, because we got some extreme poverty conditions in this country that we see on the continent over there and other places. And I think I like what you said about education. We got to educate our people that, hey, you don't go spend no $200 for some Jordans, and this man is using Vietnamese, exploiting Vietnamese labor, you know, to have the shoes made and then sell them to you at an inflated price. Boycott Jordans until some factories is right here in our communities, since that's where most of his wealth is coming from. So I'm just saying, it's not really a question, I guess, but a statement that I hope that we don't neglect our situations where we are. Thank you, brother.
Thank you for your call, man.
Thank you.
You know, Brother Zombie, before we start winding things down, because I know that you have a trip you got to make. But let me.
Yeah,
make
and I was just looking at the time. Like,
yeah, I know. I'm gonna wind it down. But let me make a comment based on what the brother was just talking about. See, that's why in the beginning of the conversation, I spent so much time talking about your work re-educating youth. And I emphasized the re-education. When you talked about Dr. Kamban, when he was on the program a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
he made mention, and I don't know whether you heard it, he made mention of having our folks come from the United States and move there with a European mentality. I don't know whether you caught mm-hmm. that.
I heard it.
Okay. See, when examples are given of all this type of exploitation and using people almost like slave labor and paying them poverty wages, that's a Eurocentric. All that type of exploitation and abuse, our people didn't practice those things. When me and Richard, when we talked 3 weeks ago, Richard, about our people not looking at Kwanzaa as a holiday, but start incorporating those seven principles of the Nguza Saba into our being, those seven principles don't lead to exploitation and abuse. It don't lead to that type of mentality. But if we go anywhere, whether it's the continent, South America, the islands, with a Eurocentric mentality, as I'm going to move here, I'm going to create a business, and I can exploit these people, then sure, that's going to lead to problems. That's why we had to re-educate our minds. We've been poisoned here by this man. It's a poison. And that's not a racist statement. That's a fact. Our people have been poisoned by dealing with this society we live under, full of violence and exploitation. This country was built on violence and genocide. So we can't practice any of this type of crap. That's why we got to spend more time re-educating ourselves first. And you have done that. You've not only in your life spent time re-educating yourselves, but you're passing this down to another generation. That re-education is a first principle. Now you're going to the continent so they can see for themselves, and then business opportunities and investments. So it's steps. You've covered a couple of steps already. But the first step mm-hmm. that anybody has to do is to re-educate our minds, because we've been poisoned here. And I don't care whether you're a Pan-Africanist or somebody that's ignorant in the street. And when I say ignorant, I'm saying not stupid ignorant, but somebody that don't know. We all have to practice the re-education of our minds, because we've all been affected.
Right.
So when we realize that we've been poisoned, then we can understand what we need to do to keep our minds on an even keel. I just want to make mention of that, because I don't think anybody is talking about going anywhere and practicing the same type of Eurocentric business practices that we're exposed to here. Yep. I just wanted to make mention of that. Let's take another call before we kind of wind things down with you, Brother Sammy. We'll do it about five more minutes, because I know you got to get out of here. Let's go to 602. 602?
Yes, Brother Eliak and Brother Richard and Brother Diallo. This is Brother Marcus from Memphis.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. the young brother talking a lot of sense. You know, that is the solution, brother. You know, because, you know, we join economically with our people on the continent, and we join here economically. We can lift ourselves both up. You see, we can pull up ourselves. You see, you be our eyes in Africa, and we be your eyes here. You know, for those who don't want to leave America, we still trade together. You see, and that's where that joint venture come in. We establish a joint venture with our people on the continent. You see, that we don't have no class, because that's what happened in Liberia and Sierra Leone. You see, that's why they fail, because as the brother Elliot said, they took that European mentality and developed an overlord over them people, and it create problems. But if we do a joint venture together, we say, look, we're going to pull you up, and we're going to pull up ourselves together. Both of us can come up. So the brother, you're right on point. I'm going to definitely network with you, because I have some financing program I have that you can plug into your program too. See, so that's where the network comes in. So definitely I'll continue listening. And the brother, you're on the right track. We keep on keeping on. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah, I appreciate it. All right. And internet.
Brother Leal?
Yeah.
Listen, go ahead.
No, I think it's important, because we tend to, I think, sometimes where we are.
Oh, wait, so I think we broke up a little bit. Say that again.
I said I think sometimes we tend to villainize those who are not where we are.
Okay.
So those who either haven't reached a level of consciousness where we are, or those who just may need some more education, or, you know, so if you're interested in full repatriation and somebody isn't, then it's like, oh, you a slave. No. How are you going to work together if you call him a slave because he's not interested in full repatriation? For whatever reason, you feel like you want to stay here. So it's like, well, let's find a common thread then. What can we do together? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because you're not going to expect everybody to fully repatriate. You're not going to expect everybody to just say, I'm leaving and I'm never coming back.
Yes.
And, you know, I know I don't expect that. So, you know, I just know that, hey, look, this is where I am. You know, but I do think that everybody owes it to themselves to at least make a visit.
Brother Sunbury, before you go, you know, I wanted you, in brief, can you tell us that Right to Abode program, can you tell us in brief what that is? Because I know you got to get out of here.
Yeah, I can't actually give you, because I don't want to misquote and I don't want to misinform the audience about it. But I do know, and I forget the exact year, that Ghana, when they released that Right to Abode, it was to say that Africans in the diaspora can come find a home in Ghana, right?
Okay.
Now, what I can talk about specifically is that there's a group of individuals in Ghana led by a brother by the name of Dr. Hammond Maulana, who I'll actually connect you with on email, because I really think he needs to be on this show.
Great. Okay.
And he is working with the Ghanaian Tourism Authority, and they recently in 2016 had 34 diasporan Africans who were granted citizenship. They were granted dual citizenship in Ghana. Okay. And I do know that they are currently working with the Ghanaian government, and I can say this, to help them figure out how to streamline that dual Ghanaian citizenship so that African Americans and other Africans in the diaspora who are interested in having that dual citizenship have a clear streamlined process that they could go through. They have a clear streamlined process that they can find online, that they can follow to gain their dual citizenship. And I do know that that's in the works right now. It's something that they're actively doing. It's a brother who I met when I was there, an elder, and who, after meeting him, I definitely made sure that I incorporated him speaking with all of my groups that I take there in Ghana.
Okay. All right. We'll talk, because I want to get that information from you so we can kind of get him on the program.
Okay.
Listen, before you go, brother, give us any information, how the people can contact, how they can get involved and be a part of the tour, how they can donate to what's going on, especially our listeners that's in that area, how they can be involved in the Adinkra group, or like Richard was saying, at least invest in what you're doing. Give out any information you want to before you get ready to go.
So you can reach us online at www.theadinkragroup.com. When you go there, you'll see the various institutions and projects that we work with regularly right there on the homepage. You can email us at theadinkragroup@gmail.com. You can find us on all social media that way. Whether you send a message through our Facebook page or whether you send a message through Instagram or Twitter or email, we do our best to get back to you in 48 hours. We will continue to maintain a relationship with you all and begin to actually, I was listening to the advertisements when we was on break, and I'm like, we need to put together a commercial. So I will contact you about that, about some paid advertisers to see what your packages are, so that how we can continue to inform your listening audience about what it is that we're doing.
Oh, great, brother. That's all a part of Richard. It's family, man. It's family. That's all I got to say. Listen, Brother Summery, I'm glad to have you with us this evening. I'm looking forward to getting that other information from you and looking forward to updates, especially after you take the group over there and they come back in March.
Definitely.
You know, you come on and bring some people on that went with you, because I'd like to hear their testimonies to what they saw and how they felt.
Okay.
Listen, I'm glad to have you with us this evening, man, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. Peace, brother. Thank you for the invite. I'm looking forward to staying in touch.
We'll talk soon.
All right. Peace.
All right, peace.
We'll be right back after a brief break. And we'll transition into a little open forum for the time that we're going to spend with the listening audience. Richard, how you tired?
I'm here. Good. I'm here. Brother done made me, y'all, done got me motivated here.
Okay. We'll be right back. You can join the conversation at 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
Nah, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either. Mm-mm.
Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you would on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm going to go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
Today our people can see that we're faced with a government conspiracy. This government has failed us. The senators who are filibustering concerning your and my rights, that's the government. Don't say it, Southern senators, this is the government. This is a government filibuster. It's not a segregationist filibuster. It's a government filibuster. Any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. So this government has failed us. The government itself has failed us. And the white liberals who have been posing as our friends have failed us. And once we see that all these other sources to which we've turned have failed, we stop turning to them and turn to ourselves. We need a self-help program, a do-it-yourself philosophy, a do-it-right-now philosophy, it's-already-too-late philosophy. This is what you and I need to get with. And the only way we're going to solve our problem is with a self-help program. Before we can get a self-help program started, we have to have a self-help philosophy. Black nationalism is a self-help philosophy. What's so good about it? You can stay right in the church where you are and still take black nationalism as your philosophy.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And Brother Richard.
Yes, sir.
Solutions. That's what it's all about. You just heard the words of Martin and Malcolm when Martin said, don't let anybody take your manhood, and being proud of who we are as a people. Malcolm talking about we need a self-help philosophy. It's time for this. It's past time. It's almost too late. We need to develop a new philosophy. That's what we're talking about. Changing our mindset so we can do what we have to do. We can't approach this reclamation project because we do need a reclamation project. We can't approach it with the same old type of mentality that we've been poisoned by dealing with this society and this man for over 300, 400 years. Mm-hmm. You have to prepare yourself first. Using an analogy that we all can deal with, you just can't enter into a college. You're supposed to be in school that prepares you to go to college. A lot of our people don't experience that, especially in education systems that's created for our children. But traditionally, and it's only right, that you're supposed to be taking courses, taking a curriculum to study that prepares you for higher education. Well, what we need to do for our people, we need to have our mind mentally prepared to do it. And all of these things, we just heard tonight about first educational programs here in the buildings that they have down in College Park, Maryland. Mm-hmm. And then an extension of that, traveling to the continent, finding out your DNA, finding the nations that you're from there, and then looking at other things, business opportunities and investments in your own people. It's stages of that. It's stages of that. So believe me, if you're going through this vetting process, because that's the way I look at it, if you're in it for another reason, if you're in it to exploit, if you're in it just to make money, if you're in it to set up some type of foolishness that they have here and then transfer it over there, then all of that will be exposed. We don't need that type of mentality. We got enough of that here. And believe me, they have enough of that over there. And it's work being done here to disassociate ourselves from these type of charlatans, traitors, toms, whatever word you want to use. And they're doing it on the continent. You see the messages all the time. Mm-hmm. We just got to develop more of a way where we can be a little more forceful in divorcing ourselves from these people because they're hurting us. Richard,
I liked the process as an example, you know, because, you know, as you say, it not only becomes a vetting process, you know, of a value clarification process for, you know, young people. But what he described was how even with his own family, the vetting, the value clarification, the interconnection became as a part of even close to your own personal family. And then that being generating to be able to bring more people through, because that's that type of development. That's the process for that type of development. Because the question that you're asking is how many go, and, you know, when he described how he was touched at 14 going, you know, he got, but if it wasn't for his family, his mother setting that process up and having that extended family, he would have never been touched. If he wouldn't have been touched, look at the families he's touching now. Now, that ain't in 50 years. That's, you know, and I don't know, but it doesn't seem like you can give it maybe 20, 25, 30. But we'd have moved into two generations now, not only him, not his, his children, an extended family.
Yes.
That's the beauty of when you talk about the vetting, because all who go through and get their DNA, they ain't going to stay, but there will be some. And as he said, someone's going to want to, you know, get that bug and want to live there. You know, like me, want to, you know, because the weather, we can't deal with the weather here, but okay, maybe that shouldn't be the only means, but, you know, and others will want to stay here. But they'll be culturally, they'll be value centered, as you say with that Nguza Saba. They'll be culturally centered. They'll know what I call classical African music.
That drumming and dancing, that's classical. Not the European Mozart. They call that classical. But classical African music relates to storytelling, information dissemination about how our culture came into being. That's what they're teaching.
Mm-hmm.
They ain't teaching that in public school and charter school. They're teaching that in that class where they're doing that drumming and dancing. You know, it's interesting that they had Baba Dr. Charles Finch there at their yesterday event they had. And Dr. Finch's whole thing is about how our culture is centered in knowledge about the universe, how the universe began, how human society began, since human society began in Africa, amongst African people. The value systems that Africans came to discover that was the best way to create harmony that was in relationship to the cosmos and in relationship to our social order. That's what the Maafa disrupted. That's what we're bringing back together. And these kind of entities that Brother Sumbri is pulling together and the Brother Kamban and, you know, Sister Nataki, these are two generations. These are the ones we see. There's others out there.
Yeah. It's people doing this work, Richard. I mean, listen, we can't buy into the narrative that this man puts out about our people not doing anything and we're just sitting around. And it's people out here doing this work. We try to utilize the medium that we have to showcase the people out here doing this work, not just proposing ideas. I think we can do this. Why don't we do that? No. These people that we're bringing on, Richard, they are doing it already.
And
the thing about
support.
It, Richard, that I noticed that
and need our support.
Yes. But when they're doing the work, all of a sudden they link up with other people that want to do the work and help them expand what they're doing.
That's right.
When he said that he made a partnership with African Ancestry.com, all of a sudden the director of African Ancestry.com said there's a meeting here with some Ghanaian tourism, and I want you to meet them. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, this partnership. He talked about before he left advertising with Time for Awakening. See, all of this stuff starts to link up when you're doing something to try to help your people.
That's you know, and I don't even know if I'm supposed to do it. But I was thinking about Uplifting Us and Sister Nataki, you know, and what 365, you know, Black 365, all of these here entities. And as you say, this platform, our communicating and being able to bring in dialogue, it's another part of that vetting. Because we get to see, if we don't even know, we get in our informational exchange, we get to see, we get to feel whether this is, because we should be looking at not just our social relationship, but do we want to invest our energy, our time, or our resources with the people that come before us? That's the question that we're always asking. When you say about living with those seven principles of the Ngusa Saba, well, if we are living with them, everything we are interacting with is coming down to that. Are we going willing to invest with each other? Do we have the value? And as he said, and I was really pleased to hear him say that as a person, look, I'm still developing. But from where I am, we have to be clear that where we are, or as he said, the why of it. That's powerful. Because any of our listening audience should be raising the question, is that resource, those children, those families that he's going to be taking the continent, that early development of that enterprise, is it worth an investment? Yes, you need to do your homework, but you get a sense, is it worth an investment? Not just listening, because we can listen to each other all along, but that doesn't help build. That doesn't do what Malcolm was saying. you know, we have to listen and we have to maintain in those principles that moral authority, which is what King was saying, right?
Yeah.
Right. We have to look at each other from the perspective of that moral authority. Are you expressing the morality that would be necessary in order to be able to create a just society compared to what these capitalists, those who created this Maafa, did? That's, you know, that's what we're engaged in.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, all of these things kind of, that I always refer back to that clip by Elder John Henry Clark in the beginning of the program, that history is a clock that people can use to tell their political and cultural time of day.
Right.
I mean, we got to know what time it is.
Right.
We got to know what time. That way, when we hear ignorant statements by these fools in government, and notice I said in government, because I'm not going to focus in on this clown that's the president, because all of them is in the same boat as far as I'm concerned, Democrat and Republican. Mm-hmm. When we hear these statements coming from the mouths of these people, then we know what we're dealing with. We should have known all along. And then we know what we have to do. It don't surprise me when I hear this stuff. The stuff that angers me is some of our people's reaction to this stuff. We need to be a little more farther ahead so this stuff don't surprise us, and hold our people accountable that's supposed to know better. It's different if you're ignorant and you need to be aware of some things. Then somebody can teach you, no matter what it is. But for somebody that knows better and knows and decides to do the opposite, our people got to start holding these people accountable. Listen, this president was holding some type of acknowledgement of Dr. King, I think, the other day. And he had a bunch of black folks up there. Looked like about 10 of them in a line, because after he was done, he started walking down the line shaking their hands. Right. And I think the White House correspondent, April Ryan, the only black one, and she happened to be screaming out, Mr. President, are you a racist? Are you a racist? He never acknowledged her. But he kept on going down the line shaking hands to the folks. Now, the first one that was standing beside the podium was Martin Luther King's nephew that was standing up there with Trump. Now, I'd never seen him before. He just popped on the scene. So I don't know whether in his mind he figured, well, my aunt, who was that, Martin Luther King's niece or something, that's a Republican that backs Trump? Well, maybe he figured in his mind, look, my niece is benefiting from this. Maybe I'll come out. I'll be on the podium, because I don't know where he popped up. I didn't even recognize his name. His name is not King, but he's Martin Luther King's nephew. So you see all of these people that some of these white folks think, well, I'll use these people. They might be respected. They don't know. They might be respected in the black community. I'll have him stand up here with me. But some of these people got to be held accountable, man. I guess that man is turning over in his grave, seeing some of his loved ones doing this type of stuff. He spent his life trying to help our people, and especially after he received his awakening, maybe the last couple of years of his life, when he told Belafonte, I think I've incorporated our people into a burning house. When he spent the last portion of his life trying to undo, maybe that's the wrong word when I say undo, trying to expand on some of the things that he was learning, I'll use that term, that led to the end of his life. Yeah, and then you hear people talking all this stuff, foolish, his own flesh and blood, coming out with all this old foolishness. We know what we got to deal with. We know what we're dealing with. Yes, you know, when Brother Sumry talked about, he said, you see all these other nationalities that's there. He said, they're there. These people ain't there wasting time. They realize that that's the center of the universe. That's the center of our solar system, is that continent. Our ancestors realized it. The blessings of the Almighty was there. We were the first people here. Now, if people don't believe in high power, that's up to them. But those things happen for a reason. It's time for our people to wake up. And believe me, we can do business. Listen, our people was doing business before this European came out of a cave. So we don't have to think that doing business, we got to do it the way he does it. This man is a Johnny come lately on the world scene. We need to do business the way our ancestors did it, with principle and dignity. And it can be done.
Yes, it can.
We got a call or two on here. Let me, Richard, I want to read something here. And it deals with, we touched on it Friday a little bit. But, you know, they put out those unemployment figures about 2-3 weeks ago and talked about black unemployment being the lowest since they've been keeping these statistics. I think in 1972. And the unemployment at that time was 11.2%. So black people have been dealing with double-digit unemployment for 40 years. Listen, white folks wouldn't deal with 1 year of double-digit unemployment. It would destroy the economy. So it has destroyed black folks' economy, the economy of their community. But let me read this, because it dealt with that ruling that happened, because Richmond, Virginia, was a test case. Well, not a test case. When they struck down that affirmative action in Richmond, it kind of spread all over the country, because they do different things with different laws to see how it flies, and then other localities and other states adopt it. But let me read this, and I'm going to tie it all in together, because they talk about this black unemployment rate, and that was in December. So when the new statistics come out, you can see that it'll go back up to almost where it's been for the past 40 years. But that's not my point. Let me read this. And this was from a published report in the New York Times. And this was in 1989. Richmond, Virginia, January 24th. All things considered, a case may be made that this city no longer qualifies as the capital of the Confederacy. At least not in the old sense. The city's hotels and restaurants and schools have been integrated the better part of two decades. The mayor of the city is black. The city council is predominantly black. And in recent weeks, a black has been admitted to membership in the Commonwealth Club, a private social enclave that has long been viewed by civil rights activists as Richmond's ultimate bastion of unreconstruction. Now there's another measure of just how far Richmond has progressed down the civil rights path since Grant burned the place down almost 125 years ago. On Monday, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the city has gone too far in requiring that minority businesses be awarded at least 30% of all city contracts. The decision came as bitter and ironic blow to Richmond's blacks, who accounted for over half of the city's population. The contract requirement, similar to requirements found in other major cities, counties, and states around the country, was one of the early steps taken by the city council after blacks first took control almost a decade ago. But now I worry. We've been making good progress in race relations in Richmond, but now I worry, says Henry L. Marsh, the third, a black member of city council, a mayor, and a veteran civil rights lawyer. Like many black leaders, Mr. Marsh considered economic progress to be the biggest problem now facing blacks, not just in Richmond, but elsewhere in the country. He and other black leaders argue that affirmative action laws, like the ones thrown out by the Supreme Court, have proved to be one of the best ways to assure black share in America's economic dream. Now, this article was from January 25th, 1989, in the New York Times. And it talked about what happened in Richmond when they took that case to the Supreme Court, and how that the affirmative action laws required at least 30% of all city contracts go to minorities. And the mayor at that time said, well, I worry how this is going to work out. Now, let me read. Now, this was in 1989. Now, this what I'm reading now is a couple of years old. So take that into account when I'm reading, because the stats haven't really changed much. It says, after the Supreme Court ruling, now, to remind you, I'm reading from 2015. The initial article I read was from 1989. It says, after the Supreme Court ruling in 1989, black municipal contracts in Richmond fell from 38% to 2% in a city that is 58% black. But now, in a city at that time was 56% black, now it's 43%. After the ruling, Philadelphia contracts fell from 25.2% to 3.5%. In Tampa, minority contracts ended altogether, so they didn't even have a percentage. In New York, it fell to 5%. In Chicago, it fell to 8%. In Memphis, went from went to 5.8%, while white contractors get 88.32% of the contracts. In Dallas, it's 0.63%. Now, I want to finish that, but I'm going to stop there a second. You see that the affirmative action laws allow blacks to get contracts in a lot of these cities. It mentioned that in 1989, when it was passed, that blacks had 38% of the city contracts, even though they was well over 50% of the population. 38% is low as far as I'm concerned. But it fell from 38% to 2%. And then it gave a sampling of other cities where after they seen that law pass, they did the same thing. Philadelphia, from 25% to 3%. New York, 5%. Chicago, 8%. Memphis, 5%. Whites get 88% of the contracts. Dallas, 0.63%. In Tampa, it ended altogether. So that shows you that in order to start building wealth, it ain't about a job. And a lot of these jobs ain't even paying livable wages with no benefits. It's about having contracts, building businesses. That way you can employ your community. They make sure that you don't get no businesses in cities where you pay taxes. Now let's move on to the federal, because that's municipal contracts, municipal and state, the figures I was reading. Let's move over to federal. It says under the Small Business Act, 23% of federal government contracts are required to be rewarded to small businesses. In 2011, for example, out of the budgeted $4.77 billion, $109 billion worth of government contracts went to small businesses. So there was plenty of cash up for grabs for minority-owned small businesses. Now, 5% of that federal government contract budgeted is allocated specifically to businesses that are owned by members of economically or socially disadvantaged groups. This is part of the 8A Business Development Program, which aims to help organizations owned by members of minority groups to remain competitive in government contract marketing. In federal small business contracting, award ratios for blacks are in the single digits. Now, this was in 2011 when $4.77 billion of contracts was going out. It was in the single digits. In 2011, that was under Obama, the man that blacks were so proud of. That was a shining light for some black folks. He didn't do sugar, honey, iced tea in regards to putting blacks in business so they can start employing other blacks. But he did plenty to help white bankers that had exploited blacks in the subprime mortgage and white businesses, period, according to these figures. But to some blacks that are ignorant of what this man did, they see him as some type of shining light, you know, a messiah. I don't know what they see him as instead of what he was. Now, let me finish the article. Small businesses, called the drivers and engines of growth by President Obama, attracted about $98.2 billion in government awards last year. Now, I'm reading from a 2015 article. According to the data compiled by Bloomberg News, Black operated businesses won only 7.2% of that figure, which relate would comes out to 7.1 billion. Contracts for black owned small companies declined about 1% the fiscal year that ended September 30th. Still black small businesses are playing catch up following sharp contracting declines in fiscal year 2011 that outpace those of small businesses and other companies. Awards to black-owned businesses plunged 6.5% from fiscal year 2010, more than four times the decline of all other contracts. Harry Alford, chief executive of Washington-based National Black Chamber of Commerce, said the percentage of small business contracts going to black-owned firms should be double what it is now. The census data showed that almost one in four black households live in poverty. The poverty rate among African Americans is 22%, more than triple the poverty rate of whites. Now, it mentioned that the black small businesses plunged 6.5% from 2010 fiscal year and had declined 1%, or had rose 1% going in 2011. So black businesses received a devastating blow under the Obama administration. And from 1989, that almost killed black businesses as far as getting municipal money in these cities and where they live at and pay taxes. That's all the more reason why we need to start a mentality where we can go somewhere else and start developing businesses. That's the lifeblood of a people, where they can employ their populace. Richard D., I mean, these stats ain't, they ain't fudged. It's right there for people to read. So if he was such a messiah to blacks, I mean, what? Come on. Now they put out that it's a black that's going to build this library. Yeah, okay, I mean, come on here. Look at all the damage that had been done during that administration. Our people got to wake up and see what we're dealing with, what we're up against. So when you hear this man make all kind of stupid comments in reference to, like I said before on Friday, he wasn't talking about no land. He's talking about the people ain't worth a sugar, honey, iced tea. Then we got to know what we're dealing with. This ain't no anomaly. He ain't no different than some of these others. Mount Rushmore, this man holds that as dear. You got four presidents' faces up there, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Roosevelt. Four staunch racists. The stench of racism and genocide just oozes from all of those clowns, even though they got stone face up there. I read that comment about Teddy Roosevelt, whose face that you see on Mount Rushmore. He made just as worse of a comment, or maybe worse, than this clown that's in office now. I read that quote he made from 1901, and I'll read it for our listening audience that didn't hear it Friday. Teddy Roosevelt, it says, "Blacks are a perfectly stupid race." In 1901, he wrote, "I have not been able to think of any solution to this terrible problem offered by the presence of the Negro on this continent. He is here and can neither be destroyed or driven away." So this man was sick and tired of seeing black folks here in this country. He used them. He used them Buffalo Soldiers, though. But he didn't want you here. That's always been the Negro problem with Europeans. They would use you, but they didn't want you here. This man was always a strange individual. He need to lay on somebody's couch because something is wrong with him mentally. Teddy Roosevelt, his comments was just as worse as this clown. Jefferson, he's another one. Let me read you some of the comments. He made a whole litany of comments. This darn pedophile, slaveholding, racist. Couldn't wait to jump in the bed with a 12-year-old young black girl. He had old white wife. I guess he was tired of seeing her ugly face. He figured he'll jump into bed with a child. Let me read some of his comments, Richard. His face is up there on Mount Rushmore, too. And I'm going to just read some of the quotes. I won't read. It says, Jefferson does not portray slavery or slaveholders in a particularly positive light. Observing how the comments of, observing how the practice arms both manners and the industry of whites. This is his comments. No man will labor for himself who can make others labor for him. But in the tract most infamous passages, he puts on his amateur anthropologist hat to make some startling observations. Citing skin color as the most obvious distinguishing figure, Jefferson argues that a slave's darker skin pigment makes them less transparent, noting that his immovable veil of black covers all of his emotions. As for his appearance, as for the appearance of whites, he argues that their features, including hair, makes them more sexually appealing, claiming that black people are sexually attracted to white people as uniformly as the presence of an orangutan for black women of his own species. So he gonna say that we crave white women. Well, some of these ignorant ones now do. But he's saying that, a craving of a black woman is almost like somebody craving an orangutan. Well, he couldn't wait to jump into bed with a 12-year-old child. She wasn't even a grown woman, a 12-year-old child. He couldn't wait. That old racist, homosexual pedophile couldn't wait to jump into bed with a 12-year-old girl. Let me finish reading some of his comments. But Jefferson goes on to profound some other further truths that what he considered black that are neither truth or self-evident. The catalog of slave biological inferiorities also include observations like a very strong, disagreeable odor. They require less sleep. Their griefs are less transient. Not only in their imagination are they dull, tasteless, and anomalous, but in every way, they're much more inferior. Jefferson acknowledged that further observation is needed to verify his conjecture, and that to achieve certainty, slaves would have to be submitted to scientific analysis, including the anatomical knife. But the conclusion he draws, one just justifies American slavery, but unmistakably clear, it is not their condition then, but nature, which concludes that he should be a slave. I mean, so, you know, listen, people only have to be surprised by Trump's comments. Some of this man's founding fathers was just as much racist as he was. Democrat, Republican, it don't matter. The thing is that matters is what we going to do. We're going to keep chasing this dream of integration and assimilation like some of these leaders been pushing that's been coming out that wasn't even our narrative in the beginning? Or we going to start talking about freedom and sovereignty from this man? That's the conversation that should be had. It's no other conversation that's even relevant as far as I'm concerned. Conversations centered around freedom.
Yeah, I hear you. It's definitely, you know, I take that some do take the position, and I agree with this about sovereignty and what, well, defining freedom in that term. But I also recognize and that there is some who see freedom defined in another term, and whether you call it integration or assimilation or whatever. And in this moment, you know, I think I left Friday, you know, I didn't make it clarify, but it's always been a part of my thought
These are two different projects that Africans have initiated in based off of this Maafra. And both of them think that that's the best way. But I kind of, you know, so it's to be seen. But as I used the metaphor Friday, you know, like watching for those who believe that they're supposed to, because we have an entitlement to citizenship that we fought and died for, that they believe that the society is going to really look at giving them something. I don't think that that's something that's just going to happen. So, but that's what I think. But it's to be seen, you know, whether that's to be true.
Let's go grab a couple of these calls and see. Let's go to Newport News. Newport News.
Oh, gentlemen, I'm just really listening in. I'm getting educated. I'm trying to find that quote you did from Roosevelt. I was researching it.
Teddy Roosevelt? Teddy Roosevelt? Say that again.
I said I really appreciate the work. I'm learning a lot tonight. I'm trying to find that quote for Roosevelt. I'm searching through it now.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, according to published reports from 1901, where he said blacks are a perfectly stupid race, he said, I have not been able to think out of any solution of this terrible problem offered by the presence of Negroes on this continent. He didn't even want you.
I will want to add one thing before I depart. I brought it up with Cynthia McKinney. I'm older, I think, than most of you. I'm 64. But I've been looking at the last 15, 16 years and seeing how much these NGOs and multinational companies are dividing up the continent of Africa. I mean, like when I put up Cheryl Mills. Cheryl Mills was the front lady for Foundation. And I put some stuff in your chat room so you can see what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They have a concerted effort to break that continent up in regions that is phenomenal, breaking it up in West Coast, East Coast. And Cheryl Mills runs a place that really, when you go to her website, if you Google it, you get a chance, Black Ivory Consulting, you'll find out she works for BlackRock. And when you start searching all of that, they're backed by Saudi investors and everything. They're talking about a 20-25-year plan for the power systems, the airports, the infrastructure, everything on that continent as though it was theirs. I'll try to send you some information on your email. So my worry is not so much what y'all are talking about, cooperative work with us on a smaller scale.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about these multi-billionaires are breaking this continent up as though it was the, you know, the early days of the U.S. continent.
But yeah, I think that even though that being true, and I've seen that too, and been watching, you know, that development too, especially when you look at South Africa, and especially if you look at the telecommunication industry, and if you do go back to 72, when you know, from that period when it was about the oil and mineral rights that they wanted to get a handle on, that there is also indigenous Africans. In that, and I really only have one, and he got killed, the Nigerian, Abioda, out of Nigeria, who was a billionaire, who recognized that they're dealing with Africa, you know, Africa should be developed, by African resources should be developed by Africans, and wanting to continue that, Pan-Africanist project, which is another part. I mean, you know, we have to put it in place. So even though that those interests, and I don't disagree with you, and I do see that, especially again with the telecommunication, when they started putting the cable works in order to deal with the communication system under Africa, it was American corporations that did that. All I'm saying, there is resistance there, you know, and that for them, for the quote-unquote multinationals that used to be national, that, you know,
that is still no new thing from the 1884 dividing up the continent. So we're not talking about something new.
Brother Rich, what I'm saying to you, I don't mean to cut you off because I've got to go and I want to get this in. Yeah. I'm going to send you some information if I can, if you stick your email or something. I'm telling you, it's much more advanced than what we thought because they're making it a collaboration between other countries. Like I said, they're using the Saudis for the funding so they can get around the government involvement. And it's becoming privatization of breaking up that continent.
Right,
so
but that's why they wanted to get Gaddafi. Right? They wanted to get Gaddafi out of it because Gaddafi realized he was anti-Saudi. And if you looked at the UN when he was at the UN in New York, he spoke bad about all of them. So I agree that it is private.
My point is. They're structuring it so it becomes the same thing we have here in America. If you look up the richest Africans, you'll find out there's one of the richest people in the world is a Nigerian. But in that country, just in the last 18 months, 35 million more Nigerians have fallen into poverty. So I'm not trying to argue or debate it. What I'm saying is I said the thing of the economic hitman so you can get an idea and read through it. I read it back in 97 when it first came out. But what I'm saying to you is, they're a lot more sophisticated than what we're looking at on the surface. And a part of going to Africa, if you're going to go there, is also to let the Africans know what we've experienced here. The details matter. Every collaboration with these white people is not necessarily a partnership. Usually it's something to get you indebted, and they have 20 and 25-year plans where they get you indebted. It appears that you're doing fine. Then they pull the financing and do the very same thing they've done to this population. Put you trillions of dollars in debt, then you're beholden to them.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate your work.
Thank you for your call, Brother Wood. Let me go to the next one here. Let's go to 646. 646.
Hey, Brother Richard and Brother Elliot. Hey, Richard, how are you feeling this evening, my good brother?
I still got this cold.
You didn't have a little bit of brandy or anything with your tea and honey?
No, can't do it yet.
See, if you didn't listen, you don't got to go work for the daddy tomorrow, right?
No.
See, they give you the holiday because the dad had a long weekend of heavy drinking and got that out of you. But listen, Elliot, you know, I really got a problem with you this evening, Elliot.
What happened?
Why you trying to take my white woman away from me? in my tone and appreciation of the great Eldridge Cleaver?
Yeah, well, listen.
Now that there was a real sick Negro, Eldridge Cleaver. Oh, man. But do you notice what's so funny? In the end, what did he become? A pork chop chicken eater. Oh, the savior. The so-called savior of the black man. The pork chop chicken eater. Unbelievable. But listen, your guest earlier this season, I had to step away, so I didn't hear him till the end. But he was very good from what he was saying. And like he was saying, we do have to take into serious consideration of us looking homeward bound and trying to do something homeward bound because, in all honesty, it's basically a wrap here for us, I think. I really don't think, truthfully, that we as a people, because of our love of this cracker, are going to move forward to liberate ourselves from his clutches. I'm the more I'm looking at it, the more I'm seeing it, the more we try to make excuses to be loved by him instead of calling him out for what he really is, it just becomes more and more apparent. I mean, some of the Negroes that they had on television this week defending that cracker Trump is just amazing.
Well, listen,
you got to be special,
Jay. That's what turns my stomach when I hear.
Yeah.
And listen, I know where they're coming from. When I say I know where they're coming from, I know their motives, and it's all about money. Basically, it's all about money. But when you hear these people that are intelligent, they're intelligent. They're all college educated, degrees. Some of them attorneys. I mean, they're not somebody that might not know. They're intelligent. When you hear them try to justify and rationalize, they got this one guy that comes on. He loves to get his face on TV. I think he got a little problem here. His wrist might be a little limp. What's that guy's name? Denard. He used to be the liaison for Bush, the black liaison under the Bush administration. And I guess he's trying to buck for that job under Trump. Man, he can't wait to come on.
He's not broken rich, though. He got a nice little black girlfriend, B.
Oh, well, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I thought he was broken rich, too, until I saw a couple of his posting and stuff like that with this sister, and you know, she basically confirmed that was her boo. But he's a real simpleton degenerate. But you know who I blame for his existence on that stage of CNN? I blame Roland Martin for that, because he was bringing that Negro apologist on for the Republican Party on his TV One show. And that's what led to him being a contributor on CNN. Just like that Negress Angela Rye, who everybody loves, and Simone and the rest of them. You know, they're really nothing but plants to confuse us as a people and to keep us integrated, or trying to feel as though we are integrated into this madness. You know what I mean? And I don't care what nobody say. Joy Reid is a prime example of that. You know? I mean, people really get off and feel like she's doing something with her supposed clapback. But you know something? I noticed today when this white woman got on there and started talking about Hillary Clinton and what she's done in regards to Haiti and stuff like that. Oh, no, she had to jump at the defense of that white woman, Hillary Clinton, to no end. And you've had the sister, I know I'm going to get her name wrong, from Haiti on your show at least two times that I done heard her, that done pointed out the dirty shenanigans of Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think it's something like that.
Yozili Danto.
Yeah, that's her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's been on your show. I've heard her two times point out. I've listened to Utrice Lee's show where she's had a white boy come on and basically line everything out that Hillary's foundation has done illegally. You know what I mean? So the information is out there. They just choose not to address it and deal with it. And for some reason, because of our sickness, we just totally believe that, you know, she's the best of the best and she's what's good for us. But hey, the reality is, what your boy basically told black people is, you shook on the ice tea. That's what he was saying to
you,
reality.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But we want to assume that what he's saying is racist. No, that it is racist in a sense, but it's the culture and the feeling that America truly, honestly, has for you.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know what I mean? See, what happened is, because in all honesty, black people are so marginalized, and he understands that I can say certain things to throw black people off track anytime I want to, but what I'm really doing is my attack on the other minority. See, that's the sinister thing, because I don't know if y'all know this, but I know y'all are clear and have an understanding. DACA is finished.
Mm.
You, You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
DACA is hidden. Now, is that going to lead to the government being shut down? Let me tell you this. The way I call it is, no. And if it is going to be shut down, it's going to not be shut down long enough to do any damage. And the Democrats are capitulate to get the government back up and running, and DACA's going to be finished in the process. But, you know, so-called minorities ain't peeping that game, so they're going to let it happen. And when it happens, they're going to try to blame the Republicans for it, which in actuality they are, but they'll never say that the Democrats are complicit with it. You see what I'm saying? You know, it's that game. But in the process, the damage has been already done. It's just like the whole thing, I don't know if you noticed what happened with the carrier company. You know they're going to Mexico, right? Now, Trump told those people that they wasn't going to lose their job and that carrier was going to stay there. You know what I mean? Nah, it ain't happening. Now, the white woman, I saw a little thing on Facebook where the white woman is heartbroken because now she done lost her $18 an hour job, and there ain't no prospects of her finding another job that pay that much in where she live at. And now she's going to be, you know, in a destitute situation because she was living from paycheck to paycheck like most people do. But see, nobody puts these things in context. It's always an out-of-context position with Americans because basically, in all honesty, most Americans are stupid. They believe in the system that is going to be somewhat fair to them. Whites do, mostly. Blacks, they just want to be part of the system. So whatever happens, they just feel as though it's supposed to happen. It's deep, man. We're in a lot of trouble. And like I said Friday night, we even got to figure out how we're going to build community. We need to figure out how we may have to, people like ourselves may need to find some place like Jackson, Mississippi, and do our thing. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't, we just gonna be in trouble. Or we gonna have to figure out how we gonna go back home. You know what I mean? Because I also was seeing that a lot of people are not talking about it because of what's happening with this new tax bill and certain things that are happening in the country. Revenue-wise, pensions are about to be attacked. I know I was talking with my boy last night from California, Jerry Brown, talking about cutting pensions. You know what I'm saying? Now, certain places, right. So certain places like New York, you know, they feel as though their pension ain't going to get cut. But, hey, mind you, if they start cutting pensions around the country, they'll figure out a way how to cut pensions in New York State. Because remember, at this time, they got probably more black people on pensions within the next 5 or 6 years than it will ever be. So you know they're going to have to make a move on that. Because, you know, most places in New York State, in New York City, they get good pensions, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So the thing is, you're looking at other major cities like Chicago, to where as they don't talk about it, but they've heard a lot of people in regards to their pension. You got Detroit. Well, we know it happened in Detroit and just other places, but it's never discussed within the media. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, we as the people, we need to really start talking about what you were saying, figuring out how we can do some sort of international trade and then just collectively coming together and going to some small, you know, county or town, let's say in North Carolina. Well, I wouldn't say North Carolina. I would say someplace like maybe South Carolina or some other state and just doing something, man. You know what I mean? And working collectively to just survive and try and educate our kids to look homeward bound, try and set up some sort of trade in regards to dealing on that level and building the family unit back together in that sense. Because what's happening in these inner cities, what's happening in these major cities, and all of this, man, it ain't moving us forward. Because like I said, if you don't have a community, you can't really get no services from these people that you put into elective office. That's just a game that you being played. Because in all honesty, where's an elected official going to send the resources if you don't have a community? And that's something that no one wants to even talk about and no one wants to address. And we're going to have to start putting that out in there. Because listen, if you got a place like Jacksonville, Mississippi, hey man, you know, we at that position that is in retirement, you understand what I'm saying, or whatever, we may need to collectively go someplace like Jacksonville, put together our economics and work collectively to try and do something, man. You know?
You're right. We
at this point, when we retiring, you know what retirement is like. Man, you just want to chill out, sleep late, eat good, enjoy your sports, or listen to your radio and just chill. You're not looking to get up and go to work. Now, we may just have to collectively come together and do that and bring our grandkids and our kids there if we can sustain them, educate them, and maybe try to figure out how we can do some sort of trade between here and the motherland to generate income to build and then take it from there and try to do something with the young kids to get them to be able to collectively do something, to start some type of businesses or try to do something to the point to where as they'll be able to sustain themselves economically. Because it ain't happening here, bro. It's just not the reality that we face it, because the resources for black people in this country is diminishing, man. You know? So I don't know, man. We gotta start to put some things into a planning stage. We may need to put together some think tanks. We need to definitely back away from this whole so-called democratic process that we feel or we think is going to lead us to some sort of freedom, because it ain't leading us to nothing. And you know, in all truthfulness, we're not really getting nothing in return.
Oh,
because
absolutely not.
I honestly don't think if Hillary Clinton was in office, things would be that much different, because she's a warmonger, man. She's an animal. She's had her hands on more death home than most white people have had. She's just not going to say a sugar honey iced tea hole, and she's just not going to be as blatant racist as this Neanderthal they got in office now. You know what I'm saying? But
the results will be the same.
There's no telling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no telling what she may have done since she's been in office, because remember, she's embedded to those that he's embedded to on the same level. You know what I mean? It ain't like she don't owe favors or didn't owe favors or anything like that. You know what I mean? It's just, you know what I think it is? It's the presentation of her racism and her agenda towards black people. It's like Obama, it was just a little bit smoother. You know what I mean? But if you really study the policies and the things that Obama did, he was just as wicked as the last one was. You know what I'm saying? He wasn't that much different than George Bush in regards to his policies. His job and what he did was continue to do what? To grow the empire. He never, ever, ever redressed the problems of the black community. Did you or I know of any one person from the banking crisis go to jail? Did he straighten out the banking situation to where as what happened in 2008 can't happen today, which is leading towards that that type of crises again. He didn't put anything in place to stop it. And if he did, this wing nut that's in office now is basically taking it away. So what did I tell you? We're in the same trip bag, right?
Yeah.
You got it.
I don't know. But listen, y'all have a good night. And Richard, listen, yes, man, you ain't got to go to the daddy tomorrow. Go home, have a little bit of, like I told you, tea and rum or tea and cognac or tea and some sort of alcoholic beverage, and put a onion, a raw onion, in your sock and sleep in it, and you'll feel better, brother.
Now you're showing your southern roots.
Yeah, don't listen.
Nah, man, you gotta put a cut of raw onion in half and put it in the sock and put it in your heel, and you're gonna be all right. You know, I don't want to put too many of the tricks of the trade out there, you know, because I can't tell you to go get you a white woman as a bed with as a bed warmer for the night to really get that out of you. But have a good night, brothers. Be good. And Elliot, right, listen, stop talking so bad about the white woman, Elliot. You know that's what every Negro fantasizes about having once in his lifetime.
Yeah, well, that's what one of your former presidents said.
All right, now.
We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customer, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
You all are really to be admired, and I want you to know that you have my moral support. I'm going to be praying for you. I'm going to be coming back to see you, and we are going to be demanding, when we go to Washington, that something be done, and done immediately, about these conditions. At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today, many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
Welcome back, Tom. Time for an awakening. And Richard, I want to play a clip there from the speech that you shared with me. You know, because they're little heard speeches, or they're not heard enough from Dr. King, and especially after the last 2 years of his life, when his outlook on things started to change. You don't hear a lot. You know, you hear the white narrative that's been pushed on the community that his whole life was I had a dream. But, you know, some of these other little snippets that I play, some of the segment that I want to play in a couple of minutes, they're not heard often enough. And that gives you an understanding of how his understanding started to change, his real feelings when he was speaking to an audience of his people, and gave you a perspective and an outlook on his philosophy, dealing with looking at our situation, his philosophical outlook on our situation. I got to look and pull that up, Richard. You the ones you share with me, the three ills of the society, I think.
Yeah. Three evils.
The three evils. Yeah. Let me pull that up and play a small clip, a snippet for our listening audience. If I can grab that, give me 1 second here.
Mr. Chairman, friends and brothers in this first gathering of the National Conference on New Politics, ladies and gentlemen, can you hear me in the back? I don't know if the Klan is in here tonight or not with all the trouble we're having with these microphones. And seldom, if ever, we're still working with it.
As I was about to say, seldom, if ever, has such a diverse and truly ecumenical gathering convened under the aegis of politics in our nation. And I want to commend the leadership of the National Conference on New Politics for all of the great work that they have done in making this significant convention possible. Indeed, by our very nature, we affirm that something new is taking place on the American political horizon. We have come here from the dusty plantations of the Deep South and the depressing ghettos of the North. We have come from the great universities and the flourishing suburbs. We have come from Appalachian poverty and from conscience-stricken wealth. But we have come. And we have come here because we shared a common concern for the moral health of our nation. We have come because our eyes have seen through the superficial glory and glitter of our society and observed the coming of judgment. Like the prophet of old, we have read the handwriting on the wall. We have seen our nation weighed in the balance of history and found wanting. We have come because we see this as a dark hour in the affairs of men. For most of us, this is a new mood. We are traditionally the idealists. We are the marchers from Mississippi and Selma and Washington who staked our lives on the American dream during the first half of this decade. Many assemble here campaigned assiduously for Lyndon Johnson in 1964 because we could not stand idly by and watch our nation contaminated by the 18th century policies of Goldwaterism. We were the hardcore activists who were willing to believe that Southerners could be reconstructed in the constitutional image. We were the dreamers of a dream. That dark yesterdays of man's inhumanity to man would soon be transformed into bright tomorrows of justice. Now it is hard to escape the disillusionment of betrayal. Our hopes have been blasted and our dreams have been shattered. The promise of a great society was shipwrecked off the coast of Asia on the dreadful peninsula of Vietnam. The poor black and white, are still perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. What happens to a dream deferred? It leads to bewildering frustration and corroding bitterness. I came to see this in a personal experience here in Chicago last summer. In all the speaking that I have done in the United States before varied audiences, including some hostile whites, the only time that I have ever been booed was one night in our regular weekly mass meeting by some angry young men of our movement. I went home that night with an ugly feeling. Selfishly, I thought of my sufferings and sacrifices over the last 12 years. Why would they boo one so close to them? But as I lay awake thinking, I finally came to myself. And I could not for the life of me have less in patience and understanding for those young men.
For 12 years, I and others like me had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. This situation is all the more ominous in view of the rising expectations of men the world over. The deep rumblings that we hear today, the rumbling of discontent, is the thunder of disinherited masses rising from dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom. All over the world, like a fever, freedom is spreading in the widest liberation movement in history. The great masses of people are determined to end the exploitation of our races and lands. And in one majestic chorus, they are singing in the words of our freedom song, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn us around." And so the collision course is set. The people cry for freedom, and the Congress attempts to legislate repression. Millions, yes, billions, are appropriated for mass murder. But the most meager pittance of foreign aid for international development is crushed in the surge of reaction. Unemployment rages at a major depression level in the black ghettos, but the bipartisan response is an anti-riot bill rather than a serious poverty program. DeMonte's proposals for model cities, rent supplement, and rat control, pitiful as they were to begin with, get caught in the maze of congressional inaction. And I submit to you tonight that a Congress that proves to be more anti-Negro than anti-rat needs to be dismissed.
Richard.
Yeah. You know, when I heard that, I said, you know, I could not do anything but compare that moment and now and see no difference.
And no difference. And you know what? And see, those are the things. Listen, it gets me sick to my stomach. I heard the terrestrial radio here all last week. They would have a white clergy and a black clergy on there, and both of them, especially the white clergies, on different days, was talking about Dr. King's dream and I had a dream. Listen, you heard the man's own words. That speech you submitted, Richard, was a year before he was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
You heard the man saying his own words that I got all these people to back this Democratic Party. He said, we voted in Lyndon Johnson. He said, the people that marched. And he said, this dream that I told them, he said, you know, basically what he said, it turned into a nightmare for him. Right. He said, I got booed by my own people. He said, I went home, and he said, first he was offended. He said, I've been out here 12 years working. But then he came to the realization why he was booing. And he admitted it. He was man enough to admit it in front of all these people. He said, I told them people to have faith in a people that is totally unfaithful. What is that? Who is he talking about? What is that telling you? These are the conversations. If we want to talk about King tomorrow, Because you got a lot of black organizations going there, day of service. A lot of these white folks have told them to go out there and volunteer cleaning up lots and all that other stuff. They need to have a day of service where they go in there and reflect on some of these latter speeches and see what it means for them today. See what he's saying. He said he got the people to buy into something, support candidates, buy into laws being changed, because he said he got them to have faith in some in people that are unfaithful.
And they were working, you know, and when he opened up, he was thanking that National Conference of New Politics. They were then saying that the Democratic and the Republican Party was bankrupt. And they had to come up with a new political strategy, you know, which it was, you know, again, that's what we hear in the day. I mean, we're saying more vocally after 50 years, what do we expect to gain from the Democratic and Republican Party?
Yeah, well, like you said, that a lot of that's, and the way he ended that speech. When he said that,
I thought that was funny, though.
The people need jobs, and he said all you hear from the administration is anti-riot, more anti-riot gear.
Mm-hmm. And isn't that what Jeff Sessions is pushing?
Ain't no different. It's no different.
And that's what makes it a structural challenge. That's what makes it a system. But at the same time, the system has fractures, and that's what. And maybe personally, I'm still in that idealist mode, or maybe wishful, you know, magical thinking mode. But when they tell you from the geopolitical level, I mean, the banks almost collapsed. What, almost close to nine years ago?
Yeah,
they had to print. And that was at that time. Again, when they took it off the gold standard, it was about to collapse then. But why? Because the people were dissatisfied with what was coming out of the economic leadership, the political leadership. They seen that capitalism, as it's being played out, they weren't getting any thing from it. And they had to come up. They had to go into them rooms and them libraries and come up with new strategies. Well, When that collapse came, they went into those rooms and libraries, and to go to your point, they came up with Obama. The people, I mean, wasn't it, you know, people were sleeping in the streets, you know, around city halls. I forgot what they called it. You know, they started to slogan the 1% against the 99%. These are things that was populist unrest. The populist unrest amongst whites gave you Trump. And that wasn't just here amongst whites. They're talking about Germany and Britain. That's populist unrest about the way the structure is satisfying people. So, you know, there is something going on. And there is projects that, you know, and I call them projects because for us as African people, you know, regardless which side of the fence we're on, the projects we're engaged in is not something that just happened yesterday or the last 4-year election, last 8-year election. They've been going on centuries too. When you say Africans who want sovereignty, whether that's continental sovereignty, Africans controlling Africa, not as just their nation state, but as a continent, those African leaders from the 60s to 70s that were killed by government-inspired hitmen, that they weren't just, they knew they had multinationals or nationals or corporations that supported. They knew that. And they came to leadership of those nation states in Africa. They came to leadership in Mississippi, because they knew they could be able to organize the people in order to try to create a new way, a new day, a new economic order. So, you know, I just think, you know, we have to be clear. What King was dealing with is that moral imperative. But those young people who were angry, and I was just reading something by Cabral, which was Returned to the Source, and he was dealing with the cultural aspect, but Walter Rodney, and he was saying the difference between the past, looking at this, you know, when Black people were just trying to give just the moral imperative. But what happened during those times in the 60s and 70s, it was those young people that was booing him. They were saying, we're going to take this to the street.
And they did, yeah.
We don't know what's going to happen now. As you laid out, the economic, the business development, the, you know, municipal contracts being not being given, or the movement. What was that? That wasn't even 10 years.
I know it. That wasn't even 10 years.
From 30% to 2%.
To 2%.
To 25% to 5%.
And 1%. And the thing about it, Richard, those cities that was used as examples had the same governmental makeup as Richmond. Black mayor, Black city council, major Black offices held by, major Black offices, major offices held by Black folks. But the